the Minnesota House and Senate omnibus public safety judiciary corrections bill. We are conducting this hearing via remote hearing consistent with House and Senate rules that allow us to do that. Folks can visit our website to be able to see what that rule is and also how to access this hearing via live streaming video. Today, members and for the public, the way it works, conference committee is at every other meeting. There's a changing of the gavel. And so yesterday we held a pretty rich hearing with the Senate with the gavel on that hearing. And today the House has the gavel, and it's my intention to have a good rich hearing today. The House will be focusing on corrections reform and prison safety. We'll be making an offer as a part of that. And again, for the public more than for our members, the way this typically works is that both bodies, given the charge of coming up with one consistent bill, we come into these meetings with all sorts of ideas, more than ideas, with provisions that have passed our respective floors. And then we negotiate to come to an agreement on the language and the topics and issues that we want to forward back to our bodies for final passage of one bill. And the way we do that is several fold, but one way in terms of transparency is to put offers, what are called offers, on the table where we package particular provisions in both bills, and we offer them to the other body to accept. The other body doesn't accept, they can refuse to accept it, or they can make a counteroffer based on that. So that's what we're trying to do is build our bill. Today is May 8th. We're supposed to be done per our Constitution on May 17th. So we're, 9 days away from that. And frankly, it's my opinion that if we don't have something fashioned together by no later than 7 days from now, that we are going to be flirting pretty dangerously with not being able to finish our work on time. And it's certainly my position as chair of the House conferees that we indeed do finish our work on time. And so that's why the House has been putting offers on the table. We have three at this point. Our first one was made on Tuesday, which is 4 days ago. The same and similars offer, same and similars for the public is language that is found in pretty much the same language, if not the same language, found in both bills. It's typically a way to get started, to show good faith that we are intent on building a bill together. So at this point, I'm going to pause and ask the Senate, since they've had our first offer, same and similars before them, for a good solid 4 days, what their response is, if any.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've looked over your first two proposals. I couldn't help but notice that we're getting into a pattern. We now have three separate proposals from you with a collection of anywhere from 8 to 12 line items on each one. And I'm just a little concerned at this time, wanting to negotiate on a small handful of separate, basically one line descriptions. We're supposed to agree or disagree with those without the whole picture of the bills before us. And it's I get a little concerned of agreeing or not agreeing to certain things without the whole picture. As you know, we do not have budget targets at this time. We were told that we were supposed to have those yesterday, but some hang-up that I don't know about has caused their delay. I've looked over some of these proposals, but nevertheless, a one-line description hardly gives me a definition of what there is. And I was wondering, is there ever going to be a time when the House reviews the language, the actual black and white language in the bill, other than just a one-line description of the proposals that you want? We had a bipartisan reference to that last Thursday when Senator Latz raised the question of when do we get to the actual proposals in writing. I believe that was late on Thursday. And it's rather difficult to understand the direction of the House with only a one-line description. So that's giving us a little difficulty in coming to any conclusion. Plus, I would imagine now that I've had proposals from over three separate days, it looks like the House is kind of dribbling out their bill. In its, maybe we get to the full completion of it, but when do we get to the language descriptions and review the language in your version? Because otherwise, it's somewhat difficult to come to a conclusion on these items.
Well, Senator Limmer, Chair Limmer, you raised several questions. I'll try to answer from the House perspective, each of them, and do so respectfully. First of all, you mentioned the budget target. I frankly don't know why waiting for a budget target for us to be able to adopt same and similar language and to dive into those policy provisions. Both bodies have policy provisions in their bills. You know, we could be, again, with 9 days left, we can be doing a lot of work of diving into those provisions and coming to some kind of accord. And that's what the House's approach has been. It's a very customary approach. In fact, there are committees, other committees right now, that have done precisely that. There are committees that have already adopted same and similars. And again, for the public, I just want to, you know, share, same and similar is exactly what it sounds like, that there's language that the Senate has passed, that the House has passed, which is exactly the same language, or it's pretty similar. It would seem to a reasonable person that that is a rich place to begin to getting to agreement. If we can't agree with our own language that we put forward, then I honestly don't know, how we're going to be able to do the people's work here. And so I would encourage the Senate to either own its language or just say, you know what, we don't like our language, and so we're going to reject our language, but at least respond to it. So a couple of issues there with the budget target, you know, which is really no reason not to engage in same and similar adoption or in policy, work, as well as the need to also respond to the other body. That's why we have three proposals, because we've been at this for 6 days. Unless it's the intent of the Senate to wait until the last hour to put everything on the table, which I would submit is not the most transparent, actually it's not the transparent way in which to do this in front of the public. The House's intent here has been to, in the light of day, put forward proposals that are in both bodies so that we can engage in them. As to the reading of line by line, we can certainly go back and read every line as we covered, quickly when we had our nonpartisan staff in both the House and Senate go through it. But quite frankly, the Senate has had the language in front of it for well over a week. And it's our duty as legislators to read the language in our own bills and to read the language that's being proposed to us. Chair Limmer, it seems to be the most efficient way for us to move forward isn't to spend an inordinate time reading language over provisions that we simply are not going to get to agreement to, but to offer ideas, provisions to one another. The Senate then is in a position to offer a counter offer. And based on that, we can begin to hew down where we can get into the very work that you want us to do, which is to have, you know, careful, you know, line by line description and discussion, you know, of what's in the proposal. And so there's nothing that bars the Senate from saying, House, you know, we want to talk about these five of your eight proposals. You know, let's get into those. And so, you know, that's custom and usage. I've been in here a long time. This is how we've always done this kind of work. I would think it's pretty easy for the Senate to formulate a counterproposal. And I frankly, I'm a little worried because the Senate has not taken any action whatsoever in the in these 6 days to indicate formally to the House where it wants to focus, what it wants to work on, what it's saying its priorities are for agreement. The House is certainly doing that, but we're not seeing that from the Senate. And, you know, I'm not trying to lecture the Senate at all, Chair. I'm really trying to make sure that we get our work done. And quite frankly, you know, when one negotiating partner is not putting anything on the table, it's very difficult to get any work done. All right, so I take it that the Senate does not have a response then to any of the offers, including the simple, same, and similar offer offered back on Tuesday. You know, is it the posture of the Senate that they will not respond to these offers? I guess I'm just wondering, because I may need to develop a different strategy for here, hopefully with you, about how we can construct the bill.
Mr. Chairman, we view this legislation as primarily a budget bill. Evidently, by just looking at the girth of the House bill, you do not. You see it as a combination of policy and budget. When I look at the separate individual proposals on the three proposals you've given us, I'm beginning to see some proposals that were not even in an omnibus bill. Take, for example, offer number one, item number one. I don't even believe that was part of your bill. And as you look at, I'm sorry, that's on offer number two, item number one. That's referring to the sign and release warrant proceedings. We don't even have a Senate bill on that. And as I look at the total proposals already before us, of the three proposals, there's a total of 30 items you want considered. 25 are from the House and 5 are from the Senate or recognized as a Senate. So it really seems to be an off-sided proposal. But nevertheless, we continue to look at this bill as a budget bill. And a number of these items, as we mentioned in previous hearings, many of these are standalone bills. Some of them have been passed on the Senate floor, and they're awaiting House action and could be signed by the governor within 24 hours of passage in the House. So we wouldn't even have to waste our time on those in this bill. Are we to expect more proposals every day that you meet? And if that's the case, is it going to create a collage of the entirety of your omnibus bill? And if that's the case, why don't we just start working on the entire bill?
Well, Chair Lemmer, I certainly don't think we're wasting our time here. But again, the simple answer to your inquiry is the Senate is empowered to make a counteroffer. The counteroffer could well be You know, House, you're about to pass this on the floor. We pass it on the floor. We want to keep this out for now. It's as simple as that. And I have to say, it's a little frustrating to not even be able to get a simple, simple answer. It is certainly the House's posture that we want to advocate for our positions. I would assume that's the Senate's posture as well. As to the issue again of budget and policy, quite frankly, the House's posture is that is a pretty not helpful position. Yesterday the Senate spent some time talking about a fentanyl bill with provisions that are not on the table. The House entertained that conversation in the spirit of having a conversation about a very real issue that faces Minnesotans. That's what we're doing. We're putting things on the table on very real issues that face Minnesotans. And quite frankly, if you're a Black male citizen in Minnesota, there's nothing more important than making sure that deadly force encounters don't continue to disproportionately target you, resulting in your death. So we're talking about very real issues here. And, our intent is to put those issues on the table. If the Senate wishes to reject them, they can do so. And, at some point, we may very well stop doing offers and simply just start offering motions here, one after the other, to see, where the Senate is on precisely any of these issues, because at this point, we don't really know. So, members, I'm going to continue with the hearing today, but I'm sure you can hear a little bit of frustration in my voice. My intention, I'm here on a Saturday afternoon, Saturday before Mother's Day. My intention for being here, and I hope it's everyone's intention, is to get our work done. And we cannot get our work done if one body simply refuses to offer a formal response to good faith responses on the part of this chair and the part of the House conferees. So members, today we're going to focus on corrections reform and prison safety issues. This is a large, important feature in the House bill, and we're going to hear testimony today on why it's critically important that the Minnesota legislature act this year on these issues. We will be structuring a conversation around an offer focused specifically around corrections reform and prison safety. We've already heard from the Commissioner of Corrections earlier this week during our regular conference committee hearings on the priority of these intersection of policy and appropriations resource issues. We heard of the importance of the proposed early release redesign, which could produce substantial savings to our state in a few years. And so we're going to hear from people in basically two parts today. The first part will be a general public testimony, where we hear a general background on the why this moment for us to act, what informs that action, what's the good objective evidence-based information on the proposals before us. And then we're going to walk through the provisions in the offer that we've posted and will be formally making to the Senate with supportive public testimony for each one of those components. So members, we'll start the discussion with Commissioner Schnell. Commissioner Schnell is our Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, and Commissioner Schnell will be highlighting our DLC's policy agenda and how it focuses on reform related to issues like juvenile justice, which, by the way, members, there's broad, at least in the House, strong bipartisan support for those provisions. And then speak to the urgent need to talk about a range speak to the urgent need for reforms, and then talk about the range of stakeholders who we're going to have before us today, to share their perspectives. So with that, I'm going to ask Commissioner Schnell to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Paul Schnell from Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and it's a pleasure to be here again today. The DOC's legislative agenda has been broad and robust. We realize and recognize that reforms are, we believe, urgently and critically needed, and for a whole host of reasons. Today, and I'm going to keep my comments really short, today you're going to hear from a variety of stakeholders that we have worked with in the development of these policies, and from those who have been impacted. And I want to go back to the words I use, that I use them specifically, this issue of urgency and the critical need for action. And some of this, frankly, is policy. We're going to hear today from some people, a range of different people on a range of different topics. But I can't understate the fact that some of these policy provisions are really matters of life and death. And I don't want to, I'm not going to be, I will tell you that this is not, I'm not being overly dramatic. Some of the policies that are coming forward have provisions that we believe are critical to the safety of people who are in correctional facilities across our state. And we have seen far too many deaths. And so the policies and the budget framework that are being advanced become really critical. And I think that will become clear today. We're also going to start out with just some brief conversations from some folks who have been really influential to me. One of them is Jeff Korzenek, who you're going to hear from right after I'm done here. And Mr. Korzenek is the author of a recently published book called Untapped Talent, and it's really focused on second chance hiring and kind of guide for people, for employers. And Mr. Korzenek is, I think, was, I met him shortly after being appointed to this role. He's really helped, I think, me think about what's possible and helped shape my thinking. And he is a chief investment strategist for one of the nation's leading financial institutions, has spoken in a variety of different settings, and I think will lay some framework that this is not crazy policy. This is not soft responses. This is smart, important, and critical work that we're proposing. We're also going to hear from Liz Richards, who is from Violence Free Minnesota, who has also been a person on a personal level for me, really influential in helping me think about the issues of violence, particularly violence against women. And she can talk a little bit about the importance of these correctional and criminal justice reforms as it relates to victims. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I just want members to know that I will be here through the entirety of the hearing today, as are many of our DOC staff, as questions come up as we go through the testimony. But I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here. I'm grateful that we have the chance to talk about policies that have ranged from prenatal things all the way through things like juvenile justice and safety and supervision and reforms that are needed on every front. So with that, Mr. Chair, I turn it back to you to bring on the next testifier.
Thank you, Commissioner Schnell, and I trust you'll be with us throughout this hearing in case there are questions or comments that you can offer to help us. Very well. So next we have Mr. Jeff Korzenek. Mr. Korzenek is the author of the book Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. We're looking for an economist's perspective on safety versus justice being a false choice, that in fact, safety and justice and criminal justice reform are good for the economy and therefore good for Minnesota. So welcome, Mr. Korsnick. Please state your name for the record and please provide us with your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Jeffrey Korsnick, and I'm very appreciative to the committee, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to share my research. My work revolves around, and forgive me, I'd like to share some slides on the screen, the urgency we have in recognizing that people who have committed felonies and served their time are important to incorporate into the labor force. The growth, the data you see before you is from the Congressional Budget Office, of course, nonpartisan, and it documents the historic growth of the U.S. economy, as well as projections for growth. And it shows that economic growth potential of any economy is based on two factors, and really only two factors. How fast can you grow your workforce, which is the line, the bars in green, and how fast can you grow their productivity, which is in blue. Productivity tends to come and go, but we have a problem looking forward to U.S. growth being very stunted and very limited because of a declining trends in our workforce growth. That's the green line. You can see it's been trending lower. It essentially dooms us in many ways to growth in the CBO's projection that is below 2% on average for over time. Not every year, of course, we're coming out of a deep recession that allows us faster growth, but over time we are limited, and we're limited because of our workforce growth. This in turn is the result of two factors. The first chart, this is data extracted from the database of the St. Louis Fed. The first is data from the World Bank that shows U.S. fertility rates. And this goes back to roughly 1960 in this chart. And you'll see that we have declining fertility in the United States. What is not always evident just looking at a chart is how striking this is today. We are well below even the rate of fertility and births we need to sustain our existing, at least native-born population, or existing population. And in fact, fertility rates and birth rates are among the lowest they've been since the 1930s. I believe we set new lows for fertility in the United States. This says that not only do we have a problem now, we're going to have a problem for many decades ahead. This has been compounded by more recent developments. The chart below, which goes back to data taken from the collected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is the workforce, the labor force participation rate. What percentage of our adult population, technically civilian, non-institutionalized adult population, do we actually have in the labor force, either currently employed or actively looking for employment? And you'll see that in the middle of the chart, the 80s and 90s, where we had rising labor force participation rates, those were decades of robust growth. We've been struggling to grow since then, in part because of declining labor force participation rates. And on the far right side, you'll see that the pandemic has dealt a very, very severe blow and made this worse. The answer becomes then, how do you address these challenges so that we can all benefit from more robust economic growth as citizens of the United States? And it becomes a question of the business community partnering with nonprofits, partnering with government authorities to better tap the resources, the potential resources we have within our population. And justice involvement is a clear barrier to full employment of that demographic within the United States. I focus in particular on the 19 million Americans who have felony convictions. Some of them are currently incarcerated, a million plus. Several million have aged out of the workforce. Some have simply dropped out of the workforce. Some are job hunting. The unemployment rate of people who have been incarcerated is roughly 27%. That was a measure taken in 2018, a time of very, very hot labor market. And many are employed, but because of their felony conviction, are employed well below their ability to contribute to the economy. When you get a population this large that is relatively underutilized or heavily underutilized, relatively untapped, this really becomes a potential for the U.S. economy. That size and that potential would not mean much. It might be a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. But we have many models in the private sector of companies that have focused on targeting this population as a talent pipeline. And what they found is if you can prepare people better, you can identify who is truly ready to turn their life around. They become, with proper support, appropriate support, they become not just adequate employees, not employees of last resort, but actually superior employees on average. But this requires reform of our system. It requires investment by business community. It requires work by nonprofits. I've had the good fortune in Minnesota, for instance, to work with a truly pioneering nonprofit called the Redemption Project, which starts pre-employment mentoring and training 6 months before release using coaches from the private sector, for example. But it also requires a change in how we address in-prison programming, how we address pre-trial incarceration, and how we address a whole framework of obstacles that we put in the way of people who are coming back and what are broadly known as collateral consequences. Some are appropriate, but many are overreaching and interfere with employment. It's typical or common to think, or traditional to think, of the trade-off between public safety and restrictions as a straight line. And there's an old paradigm of you're either tough on crime or you're soft on crime. I argue in my work, and I believe the evidence well supports the notion that it's not a straight line trade-off, that you can have a level of restriction, supervision, level focus on punishment over rehabilitation, a lack of investment, that all ends up actually taking away from public safety if it takes away from the ability of people who exit prisons to become gainfully employed and contributing members of society. So the way to illustrate that is with this chart. This is a familiar chart to many in economics that talk about trade-offs in, say, taxation levels. This is a look at a conceptual framework for looking at restrictions and supervision with regard to public safety. You absolutely need some to enhance public safety, but when the restrictions, when the emphasis on punishment is so great, when post-conviction supervision, say community supervision like probation or parole, is so onerous, all these things can add up, making it harder for people with criminal convictions to re-enter society successfully. And that means that we actually have negative returns when we add more and more restrictions. No one can say for sure where we are with every policy on this curve, but I feel very confident in my work. And again, I think that the studies that are out there based on specific policy suggest that we are at the point where we can make better justice reform decisions, lighten some of the burdens, invest more in rehabilitation programming rather than punitive, having a punitive focus, and that we will actually enhance public safety. We all have a vested interest in this. There's the macroeconomic interest. We're already feeling the pinch of a coming labor shortage for a variety of reasons. The demographics of the United States suggest that that labor shortage will only get worse. But we also have this issue, a need to understand that we should all be not tough on crime, not soft on crime. We all should all be pro-public safety and pro-opportunities, and that those in many cases can go hand in hand. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Korsenek. And also, I'd like to ask you if you can stick around for a bit. We will hear from one other person, and I'm going to open this up for discussion.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. I appreciate your work on, the evidence-based, research-based work that provides groundings for government to be doing things differently and better. With that, members, I'm going to ask Liz Richards, who's the Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota, to come forward to talk a little bit about the victim offender dichotomy. Is that a true or false dichotomy? Is it a helpful one? Is accountability only about punishment, or is it something bigger than that and more hopeful than that? And so, Ms. Richards, welcome to the conference committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Chair Mariani, Chair Limmer, members of the committee. I'm Liz Richards, the Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse. I represent our 90-member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victims across the state. I'm here to talk about victimization and reforms within the correctional system. Historically, the view has been that victim safety was maximized by increasing punishments, having longer sentences, more jail time, more prison time. And we as a coalition helped advance that thinking. But in working with our programs and hearing from victim survivors, we have learned a lot over the years and have really shifted our thinking. We know that victim safety is actually enhanced with good criminal legal system reforms and good correctional reforms. So I want to highlight a few things that we know about victimization and corrections. We know that many domestic violence victims remain in relationship with the person who used violence. They may remain in the intimate partner relationship. They may have children in common. But in these situations and for many others, what the victims want is for the violence to stop, for the behavior to change. They want to see the person who used violence be in treatment, to be involved in effective programming that will change the violent behavior. We know that those who are serving time in prison still interact with their families. Most of them are going to be released and returned to their communities, sometimes to the same family unit. Their families and their communities want to see the changes in violent behavior as well. We also know that for those people in prison who never again have contact with a specific domestic violence victim, they will have contact with others. They will go on to having new intimate partner relationships. One of the things we do at our coalition is we collect data and publish an annual domestic violence homicide report. And every year we see at least one homicide where the perpetrator has a history of domestic violence and they've served time in jail or prison, but they go on and they commit a homicide, and the person they commit the homicide against is a new victim. So we know that if we do not change a person's behaviors and patterns, there will be a next victim. We know that simply serving prison time does not change behavior. So the question is, how do we hold people accountable for using violence in ways that will change behavior? And the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act is a reform measure that asks those very questions. And it's looking to advance reforms along those lines. It includes things like domestic abuse transformation programming to change violent behavior. It includes support services for victim survivors to address safety needs. And it addresses the successful reentry questions about how do we reintegrate people back into their families and communities. I want to mention a couple of other things. There are other ways that the victim needs and issues show up in corrections work. We know that there are tremendous negative impacts on families when a parent is incarcerated, economic as well as psychological, emotional impacts. And we need to consider the minor children of those who are incarcerated, the Healthy Start Act, which allows women who are pregnant or immediately postpartum to be placed into community alternatives, providing treatment and programming, allowing children to remain with their mothers. This will result in better outcomes for the children and for the mothers. And finally, I want to highlight, we have historically spoken about victimization and perpetration as two wholly separate and distinct populations, and we know that's false. Violence Free Minnesota has been working for the past 2 years on a project at Shakopee Women's Correctional Facility, looking at the victimization that occurs of women that occurs prior to incarceration, and it has a specific focus on Native women. So we have interviewed 62 women who are within Shakopee or have been recently released from Shakopee. All but one of those women have extensive histories of violence and abuse prior to incarceration. National statistics show that 79% of women in federal and state prisons report past physical abuse. Over 60% report past sexual abuse. The national statistics on prior victimization of men who are now in prison, they're harder to come by, but some studies show as close to 60% of men in federal and state prisons have histories of child abuse. So we know that many of those who are within our prisons have histories of victimization, and that victimization needs to be addressed as well. So if we're going to stop cycles of violence and abuse, we need reforms within corrections. Our coalition, along with the other crime victim coalitions, have been included in the reform conversations with the Department of Corrections. And Violence Free Minnesota supports the reform initiatives that the Department of Corrections is putting forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Members, I'm going to stop now for a few minutes to see if there are any questions or comments. These are powerful frames that the House has engaged in terms of underpinning the proposals, many of the proposals before us, the change behavior, changing behavior in order to break cycles of violence concept. The concept of re-entering successfully into our society, emerging from our corrections and criminal justice systems, so that there's opportunities that can not hinder but actually help our economic and social life. So with that, let me just pause to see if there are any members that wish to question our presenters and or offer comments. My colleague, Representative Tim Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I raised my hand last second because I was going back and forth. But I do have a question to one of the testifiers can answer this. I have a real frustration right now with this. I literally got a text this morning. It's not with corrections, but it's once again of a sexual assault of a five-year-old child by someone where there's a history of repeated problems. And I know they say, well, that's why we need to have these programs, but there are programs in place. I have three other stories very similar to this that have been totally adjudicated and gone through the system. And our system that's supposed to be addressing this in other ways still is not dealing with it. And the only thing we're doing is we're having more victims. And so this frustration that I have is very real right now. So I'd like someone to explain to me, we have laws, we have programs, we have all these things that come out of St. Paul, and then they never seem to hit the ground. They never seem to get into the communities. We can talk about them in the communities, but we never see these different things. And so if we're going to be supporting future programs, what assurance can we have, or how do we accomplish actually having these programs work in real time rather than just saying that we're doing it?
May I take that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, of course, Mr. Blessing.
Thank you for your concern. And I will say I'm a member of the Council on Criminal Justice. Within the criminal justice reform community, you have a sort of a wide spectrum of people, and I tend to be kind of on the law and order side. And I've lived in, I was raised in a city that was plagued with riots when I was growing up. So I'm very sensitive to victims and the rights and challenges of that victims face. My observation from looking at this with kind of an economist's and business eye is that we are trying to, we don't do enough to distinguish between who is truly a threat to public safety and who can be rehabilitated. The models that I advocate to the business community, for instance, don't suggest that everyone can be rehabilitated. I personally do not believe that. But what we need to do, in my opinion, is identify those who can be rehabilitated, who are of minor threat to public safety, so that we can focus better. So, for instance, I saw in the language, this is not my specialty, but in the language of the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, there's a focus on a best practice out there called individualized assessments, where you're looking at people as individuals and assigning a pathway to address those issues. Same can be true of better reforms in community supervision. Why are we supervising people who are 5 years out, have clearly rebuilt their lives and re-entered society? We should be taking the focus off of people like that and focusing on the people who are repeat offenders, who are true risks to public safety. So I know that's an incomplete answer, but I hope that's a framework for looking at some of these challenges. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Professor Korsenek and Representative Miller. I'm wondering if perhaps Commissioner Schnell might want to add to that, specifically also then in terms of our state.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Miller. I mean, first, these are the most horrific kind of circumstances, and certainly things that. But I think it's not really distinct, different than what Mr. Korsenek is talking about. I think the ability to begin to measure this stuff, to really look at therapeutic interventions. We know that these things work. We have evidence. We have data that shows it works. Now, again, is there 100%? No. And I think this is where we have to start to distinguish these differences, provide other types of community supervision and supports, address accountability measures that minimize risk. And we've done some of those things, and it has made a difference. We can look at offending over the long haul and see that it has made a difference in our state. We've seen a more positive trend. At the same time, we cannot, I don't want to discount in any way, shape, or form the fact that people are really seriously and significantly harmed by these offenses. So again, I think it goes back to this notion of we can't trade. We have to recognize that these things are going to happen. But the minute we say that that's what should drive policy, we never get to a point of looking at how do we make a difference with the people we can make a difference with. And that's the challenge here, and I think these are the trade-offs. I think I would just say this, and it's really hard, putting this in the context of the given impacts. But we look at these really horrific incidents that have very real impact, and they become they are legitimate real anecdotes. But I think it was in one of Mr. Korsenek's this book. But adding an S to anecdote is not equivalent to data. In other words, we have these horrific stories and things that we have to address, and we have to minimize risk to people, reduce victimization, and make sure that we're providing the supports and accountability for people in the system. And at the same time, making sure that these incidents do not drive policy away from the opportunity that exists in helping people make a difference.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Schnell, I hope I've made it abundantly clear. I have a high level of respect for you, and not in like the professional "I respect you" sort of thing. I really appreciate what you're trying to do, and I support it and I applaud it. Maybe the better position for me, and then I'll be done here, is to be a messenger that when I have 4 cases in rural Minnesota in my district, that's not data. And I'm not criticizing the way you've made the comparison with anecdotal and data, because I understand the difference, but that's very real. That's very real evidence. My messenger to everyone here is it's not making it to the ground of what we're seeing here. And anything that we do moving forward has to have some level. I don't know if it's measurement. I don't know if what it is, but it has to prove that it's being effective. Because I will tell you that when I go and talk to these parents and I say, listen, the system's trying to help you, and then it fails them time and time again, They don't care what I'm saying in St. Paul anymore. I'm just telling you, we have to get these problems addressed. It's not working at the ground level.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, I hear you. And again, I do not want to minimize. And I will tell you that one of the things we're committed to is showing the data. Where are we hitting the mark, and where are we missing? And the problem is, when you don't focus on the individual needs of individual people that are in the system, you end up doing these kind of mass programs that everybody's supposed to plug into, how do you get the kinds of outcomes that are individualized? And I think one of the things in our proposals is that we're going to come back to this legislature and we're going to present you the data to show the places where we're making, where we're hitting it, where we're not, and then what's our strategy for addressing those places where we have continued challenges. So I'm 100% committed to that. And I think as government, we need to produce that, and we're committed to doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Very well. Chair Limmer? Chair, I think you might be muted.
Got it. Thank you. Mr. Korsnick, are you from Minnesota, or are you from somewhere else?
No, I'm a resident of St. Petersburg, Florida.
Oh, good for you. Especially in the winter months.
I'm not complaining.
I wanted to let you know, you may know this already, but Minnesota is one of the lowest states in incarceration rates in the country. Second to fourth, depending on what article you may read. As I've been around this subject for many, many years. I can count them in decades now. And the one thing that I keep noticing is every few years, we get a new mousetrap that's been invented, and they tout it as the next best thing, and will improve on rehabilitation as we invest public dollars. And somehow it just never measures up to the promise. And I'm concerned about that. I'm also concerned. I do appreciate your work on question of employment and the missing employment numbers that we'll need in the future. I appreciate that. But just employment or a skill, I don't think necessarily changes the behavior of someone that has a past life of criminal behavior. And in Minnesota, we do put our most violent people, the ones that are a danger to our society, in our prisons. And we don't always, I think others would say, you really don't change a person until you change their heart. That could be through a religious conversion thing. Maybe it's finding the right spouse to marry, or sometimes they just grow out of this behavior. And I think statistics would show that by the time you get into your mid-40s, you're kind of been there and done that. You really don't want to get involved in criminal activity, and you behave entirely different, a little more mature. But as I look at it, giving someone a second chance, which is a program that we've had to various degrees of success. How do you look at it? Do you see that a simple vocational interest is going to put people on a more responsible path? Because I'm not convinced of that yet.
No, and nor am I. In fact, I'm convinced of the opposite. And I believe that successful rehabilitation requires both changing hearts and minds. And vocational training is part of changing minds and giving people a pathway, but you need to change hearts as well. So for example, the program I mentioned, the nonprofit I mentioned earlier, the Redemption Project, has a curriculum that's based on virtue and giving people a different way to think. The model of second chance employment that I argue for from the business community's perspective is one that requires them to have a process that helps assess character. And some of that is in partnering with, say, some of the businesses. In particular, there's a case study of an Ohio manufacturer that partnered with the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction to get a chance. They do in-prison training. They recruit at halfway houses and prisons, but they build partnerships with prison authorities, with nonprofits, to help identify who's truly ready for employment. But there's still a need for this kind of programming because you really need both the changing hearts and minds together. And because if you don't change the minds, give employable skills, that doesn't work. So I agree with you about that. I think that is part of successful identification of what different people need. As Ms. Richards pointed out, so many people behind bars are people who have varying degrees of trauma and are victims themselves. That doesn't take away from the right to and the need to incarcerate people who are threats to public safety. I'm absolutely not a prison abolitionist. So I agree. It's not vocational training, for example. Education, pure education is very, good outcomes, evidence-based outcomes, but it also requires people to change. Some of that can be supported by programming. Some of it may be innate.
Mr. Chairman, another quick question. Mr. Korsnick, does studying the hopefully a diminished recidivism rate, is that how you measure success? How would you measure success?
So recidivism is probably as good a measure as any in terms of public. You should also see other measures of public safety. So you should see lower incidences of crime and violent crime. These things take place over time. One of the things I also want to say that I, referring back to your earlier question, agree with is there are a lot of fads out there, and some work, some don't work, and we have this swinging pendulum of, again, that old paradigm that I criticize of being too soft on crime. We let people into the community who should be better supervised, then we go too hard on crime, and we're not giving people a second chance. One of the elements that I think I focused on is long-term success models. So, for instance, a work release program in Kansas that's been around for over 30 years that has only had has a recidivism rate of roughly 3% after that time period. So things like that are evidence-based approaches. The other thing that I think is changing for the first time in many decades is the participation of the business community in a broader sense. Last Monday, there was an announcement of a Second Chance Business Coalition, which is being led by J.P. Morgan J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, and co-chaired by the CEO of Eaton Corporation of Cleveland, a power management company, Craig Arnold. And it's roughly 30 businesses. This is the blue chip names of American business, Procter & Gamble, Home Depot. And as opposed to some of the, for lack of a better term, virtue signaling that we've seen sometimes, these are very real commitments towards actual pilot programs, developing and sharing best practices within the business community. So I think that there is something truly new going on here, because we can produce all the best supply of people who've changed their hearts and minds, but if the business community isn't willing to employ them, it does no good. And I think that there is a very much a real change in the business community, in part driven by this labor shortage.
And Professor Korsnick, I was struck by the total 29 million people that you shared in your graph earlier, and obviously the collateral consequences of being formally inside this system. So just from a practical, pragmatic, rather, point of view, I can certainly see why, this issue looms large for, captains of our economy in Minnesota. Chairman Limmer, we do have Kelly Mitchell here from the Rubina Institute, who could also speak precisely on your questions in exchange with Professor Korsnick. And so I'm wondering if...
No PhD here, just
I was struggling with whether to Dr. Korsnick, but no PhD here either, so all good. Ms. Mitchell, are you here with us? I'm told that you are.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm here.
Very well. And Ms. Mitchell, I think you've heard the rich conversation with Mr. Korsnick and Chairman Limmer, and I think you might have something to add to this as well.
I do. I kind of wanted to go back to this whole question of who are we sending to prison in Minnesota? Are we sending the worst of the worst? Is it the group that can't be rehabilitated? Because we do have the fourth lowest imprisonment rate in the country. And so I can actually speak to this also as the chair of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I ran the numbers this morning to see, you know, who are we sending to prison under our sentencing guidelines? And I'd say over the past 20 years, we've sent 72,000 people to prison. So these are people that the guidelines said should go to prison, and they actually did. And of those, only 25% were people who were convicted of crimes up in the upper severity levels, where prison is always the recommended sentence. So just a quarter. So that leaves 75% of all of those people. So where did they come from? So the remaining 75% were convicted of offenses in severity levels where probation was presumptive, at lower criminal history scores, where prison was presumptive at higher criminal history scores. So criminal history is sort of the main factor why these individuals were sentenced to prison. And in some cases, mandatory minimums also override the guidelines in those zones. When we look further at that group, a third of the prison commitments were for people convicted of crimes in severity levels 2 and 4 on the main grid and D2 on the drug grid. So at these levels, the types of crimes that we're talking about are fifth degree controlled substance crimes, theft of under $5,000, check forgery, non-residential burglary. So these are low level crimes. These are definitely not the worst of the worst. But the reason that these people end up in prison is because they had higher criminal history scores. So that's the other tenet that our guidelines set forth, is that people who have longer criminal records are people that we recommend for prison. But what it means is we have a mix of people in our prisons. We have people, some who've committed very serious crimes and some who have repeatedly committed low-level crimes. And so, you know, from my perspective, what the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act is designed to do is to help all of them, but in very different ways. So, for example, people who are repeatedly committing low-level crimes, for them, the goal is to incentivize change and stop that repeat cycle of reoffending. And often that might mean addressing addiction issues, providing cognitive behavioral therapy to address criminal thinking. And then for people who commit more serious crimes, the goal is also to address reoffending, but the programming is going to be very different, right? There we might be focusing on violence prevention, other things. The point is that for each type of person in our prison, the programming has to be tailored to address the factors that result in their offending in the first place, and that will sort of stop that cycle of reoffending. So these are the factors that we can actually change through intervention. So I hope that that helps illuminate a little bit, you know, that we do have a lot of people in our prison who really could be helped if they had the right intervention targeted towards them, rather than, you know, either getting no intervention or getting the one size fits all kind of approach.
Ms. Mitchell, it seems like part of what we do, and for better or for worse, is that we learn as we apply practices. I think Chairman Limmer earlier spoke about, you know, new approaches in the past, and sometimes those are not going to work. But I think the important thing is that we review, we learn from those, and that we adjust going forward. Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to note that almost all the people in the prison are going to get out and reenter society at some point, no matter how you cut it, whether they're the worst of the worst, with, of course, some very narrow exceptions, or not. So the question is, how do you prepare them to leave prison? Because they're coming back into our neighborhoods one way or the other, into our communities one way or the other. Do we simply let them languish, or do we use the latest knowledge and expertise and information to try to give them the tools to succeed when they get out? The MRRA is not a get out of jail free card. It's not a way that any of them are avoiding prison at all. It's not something that happens up front. It happens while they're in prison, and the best they can do is reduce their prison time, actual in custody time, from 67% of their executed sentence to 50% of their executed sentence. Now, it might, for some of them, that'll be a substantial savings in time, but it's not like they get in and they get out after having served a month. And it creates incentives. Now, incentives are more powerful than punishments. And you look at all the studies across the board, even raising children. Rewards for good behavior are more powerful than punishments for bad behavior in shaping their conduct. And if we create these incentives to get into programs, to do well, to work seriously at it, to shape your behavior while you're in custody to reflect that, when you're out on parole, to maintain your programming, to shape your behavior while you're on parole in order as an incentive to reduce the length of parole, that's much more powerful. And so this is an incentive-based program. So it's not a question of, give someone a stamp in a pre-sentence investigation through this program, and they'll never see prison in the first place. We're dealing with the people who have already been sent. They've already had their PSI. They've already been sentenced. A judge found that they needed to go to prison under whatever the circumstances were. And we're trying to create a system whereby they're going to be more successful when they get out of prison. Success as defined as less recidivism. So I hope that, you're playing the odds. You always are. You're always going to have anecdotes or, I don't mean to minimize that. You're always going to have situations where someone is not successful. But when you look statistically at it, you want to increase the percentage that are successful because that does create fewer victims. And I think that's where we should keep our eye on the ball and why I think this is so important. And when you've got the corrections officials and the county attorneys, I mean, the career prosecutors supporting this, you've got law enforcement supporting this, you've got all of the professionals in the field are saying this is a really good thing. We ought to be doing that. Then maybe we need to look beyond what has failed in the past and look for things that can help us to succeed in the future. I think that's our obligation as legislators, as policymakers, to try to solve these problems. We were not elected simply to say no. We were elected to solve problems. And I think that's what we have an obligation to try to do when we have the opportunity like we have here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Latz. And these discussions is how we go about doing that. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really wanted to make the connection here with the testimony we've heard and adverse childhood experiences. It's sort of... we all have different frames in the way we see the world, but, for me, families aren't broken. People aren't bad. We have people who do behavior that's not acceptable in our society. And we know from research through the CDC that people convicted of crimes are four times as many adverse childhood experiences. And, I'm hoping most of us are familiar with those, but, being exposed to abuse, being exposed to neglect, and some of those things of not having a caregiver that's able to get you the health care that you need, living with a parent with mental illness or substance abuse. And one of the other factors is having a parent who's incarcerated. And so, there really is this cycle of, if you have a parent that's incarcerated, now you're at higher risk to be convicted of criminal behavior later on in life by virtue of having that parent taken from your day-to-day life. And so I think that's a really important, as we talk about the Healthy Start Act, but also, a lot of the things that we have in our bill and then, that have bipartisan support, making sure we're careful about what we're criminalizing and what kinds of behavior we're not criminalizing, because we're really actually digging ourselves a bigger hole, because now it's this whole cycle of putting their children at higher risk too, by taking those parents out of the home. And so I just want to make that connection, because I think it's really important. Obviously, there are a lot of those things that we don't cover necessarily in this committee, but a lot of those things we do. And I think that the policy that we put forward to add on to what Senator Latz was saying, this is our job, is to figure out the policy that's going to work best for people and actually you know, have a system that works better for more people. And so I think, just want to bring that up because I think it's a really important factor as we talk about, you know, who should be in prison and who shouldn't be in prison and whether it's helpful or unhelpful. And so I just want to lift that up. And I think the testifiers too, this is really good testimony, I think, to have on the record this afternoon. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfan. Chair Lemmer, I think you get the last word if your hand is still up and then I want to move on through.
I just have a couple of brief questions. The first one was to Ms. Mitchell. Ms. Mitchell, you gave figures that span the course of 20 years. Do you have a similar report that might span a more recent time since we did have some reform of criminal sentences, especially around the area of drug possession? And I'm just wondering if a shorter period of time would reveal a little different profile of who's in our prisons, number one.
Ms. Mitchell.
Then I have another question, Ms. Chair.
Yes, of course. Ms. Mitchell.
I have to say that one of the greatest disappointments to me in looking at the data is that our imprisonment rate and revocation rate for fifth degree drug possession, which was reduced to a gross misdemeanor for first time offenders, has not gone down for the folks who are being charged at the felony level. So no, those numbers haven't changed over time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Korzenek, you mentioned the state of Ohio with employers. Was there an issue of liability with those employers that had these programs? And in the event that something went wrong with the individual under a program, how did they handle it, or what experience did they have?
Sure. In the case of this specific employer, JBM Packaging, which is was the subject of my case study chapter, they reviewed the risk and decided that it was within their acceptable business parameters. So they essentially said, you know, the reality of negligent hiring liability is actually fairly small. It doesn't mean it's not important. I mean, I have fire insurance on my house, even though I don't expect my house to catch on fire. But negligent hiring liability is a huge concern for employers and is a major barrier. This particular employer decided that that was something they could live with their process of correction of selection, who they are selecting for employment and how they are supporting them. Other employers, say in Ohio, rely heavily on, I don't know how these are termed in Minnesota, but in their broad category is certificates of rehabilitation, which are things that people after some period of time can become eligible for that give safe harbors for employers. States like Texas actually have legislation that protects employers. And I think that's another very, very fruitful area of reform. So I completely agree. That's a very real issue for employers. It's one that deserves recognition and response in among policymakers. But many of the businesses have different responses to it. Larger businesses, it's easier to manage. The smaller mid-sized businesses, which I focused on in my book, for instance, have generally live with it or look for safe harbors like certificates of rehabilitation.
And one last question to Commissioner Schnell. Commissioner Schnell, we've been talking about a little bit of recidivism, and is that the proper indicator when a program works? You and I had a discussion through this medium a few days ago. You had made mention that there were studies in 36 to 38 states that had adopted some program. You're going to give me some information on it. I just wanted to remind you, I'm still waiting for that.
So, Mr. Chair, Chair Limmer, I believe there's a packet of information that went out today, and
great.
All of that data is in there. A lot of that that study data and information from our research folks as well as others. And I would also just say that as we look at this, yes, we do believe that their recidivism reduction is one really key measure. But success, we should look at that in a broad, you know, the number of people that we get into livable wage and employment, and there's a variety of those factors. Issues around homelessness, these are all really closely connected and core measures, but certainly recidivism is a core one, and that data has been posted.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank Mr. I keep wrestling with your name. I apologize. I want to get it right. Mr. Korzenek?
Korzenek, yes, thank you.
Very well, and Ms. Richards for being with us here today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Appreciate the rich conversation here. Members, then the next session here is to hear testimony around the bills in this present offer. And I'm going to try to move quickly because I fell behind, but the conversation was rich and I wanted to make sure that we honored that. So first we have Deputy Commissioner Curtis Shanklin, who will speak to the juvenile justice packages. Those are in House File 947, House File 922. But in the offer, members, we will you'll see those listed in the omnibus bill, the very specific sections and lines. I won't repeat them, but excuse me, these provisions have to do with strip searches of juveniles, use of disciplinary room time, prohibition of detention of kids under 13, raising the age of delinquency for 13, shackling prohibitions, the use of risk assessment instruments, and closed delinquency hearings. And so with that, I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner Shanklin to come forward.
Thank you, Chair. Can you see me?
Yes, indeed. Welcome.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you, Chair and members of the Conference Committee, for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Curtis Shanklin, Deputy Commissioner of our Reintegration and Restorative Services Unit here at the Department of Corrections. Today, I'm here to tell you that I really can't stress enough the importance of this juvenile justice package that the DOC brought forth this session and the urgent need facing our youth here in Minnesota today. As I proceed through my testimony, I want to challenge each of you to think, when is one child too many for our youth here in Minnesota? And I'll come back to that a little bit later in my testimony. Additionally, as always, I implore you to think about these provisions through the My Child test. If your daughter or son, granddaughter or grandson, or maybe even your niece or nephew made an unfortunate decision, how would you envision their experience to be with the juvenile justice system? How would you feel if your loved one was subject to our current practices? I want to take an opportunity, though, to also commend the Senate for passing the Healthy Start Act, and I look forward to the House floor vote on Monday. This legislation is monumental for the powerful impact it will have on infants here in Minnesota and in giving those kids a strong foundation for success. I also urge this committee to not forget about Minnesota's older children. Interactions with the juvenile justice system at a young age can be deeply traumatizing and have profound impacts on our Minnesota youth. These impacts exacerbate their traumas and inadvertently can make those children, the facilities that support them, and our communities less safe because they cause more harm. The juvenile justice package before you, comprised of House File 947 and House File 922, is carefully crafted to meet the needs of the youth in this state and ensures that the system kids interact with are equipped to support them. Both bills enjoy bipartisan support in the House and nearly unanimous passing out of committee. And I thank many of you on this committee for doing that important work. I also wanna send a shout out to Representative Miller too as well, who although not on the Public Safety Committee, this year has played a big role in our juvenile justice package, and I've really enjoyed our conversations both about the work going on in the juvenile justice arena, but just in criminal justice in its totality. Currently in Minnesota, our kids oftentimes face justice by geography and traumatizing, desperate treatment. Kids are subject to invasive and traumatizing strip searches and solitary confinement, which in this state we call disciplinary room time, or DRT. Children as young as 10 can be diverted away from the child welfare system and instead served by a juvenile justice system that are not developmentally equipped to understand. I want us to imagine that. A child who needs parental guidance to watch Harry Potter or even Spider-Man can end up in our criminal justice system and in secure detention facilities across the state. Children as young as 10 can be placed in secure detention facilities away from their loved ones. Youth are shackled or put in restraints in court without compelling reason, which is unnecessarily humiliating and stigmatizing, particularly when you think that one third of our young women who come into contact with the system are victims of sexual violence and sexual abuse. We don't even do this to adults anymore. Youth ages 16 to 17 in delinquency proceedings are subject to lifelong public scrutiny through the public hearing process. As someone who's an Army brat, I think about the collateral consequences that particularly maybe for a proceeding that was open to the public, that might put a hurdle up for some of our young women and men eventually moving on to join the military. Kids across Minnesota are inconsistently pushed into the juvenile justice system rather than community alternatives, and youth are disparately and sometimes inappropriately placed in detention. Katrina Dexter, director of the Juvenile Justice Reform Unit, who you all know, while not testifying today, is the architect of these proposals, which have been studied for the last 5 years. These proposals involve input from a variety of stakeholders and experts in child development and criminal justice to include extensive partnership with our colleagues at the Legal Rights Center, as well as the University of Minnesota. These current provisions would end visual strip searches and solitary confinement for our youth, will raise the age of delinquency for kids to 13, prohibit detention admissions for children who are not yet older than 12, will end the practice of indiscriminate shackling of our juveniles. It will eliminate public delinquency hearings for those 16 and 17, explicitly give authority to our law enforcement partners to utilize alternatives to detention and to build upon some of the great work that they have already been doing to divert many of our young people from the juvenile justice system to begin with. It will also mandate statewide the use of a validated risk assessment instrument at the point of detention. The solution to these issues are bipartisan and so simple. And notably, in the past years, many of these provisions have enjoyed the support of many of the conferees in this virtual room today from both sides of the aisle. I know the DOC has met with each of the conferees on this committee to talk through these provisions. They were also discussed in great detail in both the House and the Senate Public Safety and Judiciary Committees. I understand my commissioner, Commissioner Schnell, spoke to many of these urgent needs on Tuesday. As such, rather than belabor the points that have already been shared to all of you, today you will hear from someone who is also close to the problem, who will identify the need for different solutions than what is currently happening with devastating impacts in our justice system for those justice-involved youth here in Minnesota. Before we move to the second testifier, I want to circle back to what I challenge each of you to think about. When is one child too many for our youth here in Minnesota? And I ask you to think about that, because when is one child in Minnesota too many getting strip searched? When is one child sitting in solitary confinement here in Minnesota too many? When is one child being inappropriately placed in secure detention? One child too many. And when is one child being indiscriminate shackled or using the utilization of restraints? One child too many. Someone's child today is getting strip searched. Someone's child is sitting alone in solitary confinement today. And I am of the belief that any child being subjected to these practices is one child too many. Minnesota can and should be doing better. With that, I thank all of you for all the important work you are doing and will stand for questions whenever the chair feels appropriate. And I will also be remiss, because I have the opportunity to be back home in Mississippi to visit my mother for the first time in a long time, to say a pre and happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there too as well. And with that, I will conclude my testimony today, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin. And I believe we have a young person testifying today. Is that, I don't have a name, but I've got a indication that that may be the case.
Yes, Chair, that is my understanding. I believe we do have a second testifier who will be testifying.
Okay, and I don't have a name right now, and so I'll just ask the testifier to come forward, and then we'll recognize him or her at that point in time.
Chair
yes, welcome.
Chair Mariani, Chair Limmer, and members of the committee. My name is Paula Acapo, and I am a 11th grader at Math and Science Academy and a representative on the Minnesota Youth Council, and a young Black woman. And I am here today in support of youth justice policies within the House's version of the omnibus bill. I do not have any personal experiences with the juvenile justice system, but I see the way that kids of color are treated by the system, and that worries me. I worry a lot about my cousin who is in first grade. My cousin is a caring young boy. He loves to hug people. He's really curious and he has lots of energy. He's never quiet and he's always on the next thing. He laughs at almost anything. I recently taught him how to play Monopoly, and though he does not understand the money, he now wants to play all the time. But as a Black student in his school, I am concerned. I worry because there are cultural differences and issues of race, which make his teachers see him differently. Teachers say he talks too much and he's too jumpy. He has a hard time paying attention in class, and this makes me worry about how the juvenile justice system might impact him later. There is a lack of humanity in our system and so much fear about Black children, which gets weaponized. I worry that people will see my cousin as a threat, but he's not one. He's just a little kid. He only becomes a threat if people make him out to be one. Kids like my cousin won't be able to grow up successfully if they are constantly seen as a threat, especially when they're doing things that are normal or what other kids are doing. My cousin shouldn't ever be made to feel like something is wrong with him, and I don't want any child feeling that way. In schools and the juvenile justice system, I wish people would stop entering the conversation with the thought that there is something inherently wrong with these kids. We all want students to follow the rules, but it's important to allow for growth. Juvenile justice has always been a critical passion of mine, not just because it impacts people around me, it also impacts how I act myself. As a young Black woman, I often have to code switch and feel I have to be overly polite to not be seen as an angry stereotype. If I am not presenting my best self constantly, I feel like I'll be seen as a negative representation of my entire race. I'm an individual who makes mistakes just like everyone else, just like the kids who get caught in the juvenile justice system. Even though I've never been to juvenile court, or a detention center, or a correctional facility, I care about what happens to kids who are there. Everyone deserves the right to an education and to spaces where they have community. We all have the right to places for learning, growth, and connection. The kids in the juvenile justice system deserve nourishment and positive environments and shouldn't have that taken away from them because of inherent bias or feelings of lawmakers who don't know them. Passing these policies is a big first step in making sure all children have the rights they deserve. I know that you have many things to decide on during these conference negotiations, but I hope that you will choose to prioritize the children of our state and take actions this session to improve the youth justice system. Thank you. I yield my time to the chair.
Thank you, Ms. Okagbu, and thank you for your testimony, and also thank you for your work on the Minnesota Youth Council. I'm a big fan. It's a tough group of folks. I've members I've gone and offered testimony at the council, and the fact that I'm an elected state representative doesn't mean that they cut me any slack. They're tough, and they're appropriately so in terms of vetting policy issues that impact young people. With that, I'll open up questions to Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I almost say this cautiously after Mr. Shanklin said such nice things about me. I feel like we're just sharing times complimenting each other.
Here we go.
But I do have a question for you, Mr. Shanklin. It's going to be a tough one. So just be prepared. But I do want to make a comment just really quick. The reason why I support the juvenile justice program, they've come into my office multiple times over the last several years. And members and agency people and anyone else who cares to be listening to this at this time, if you want to know, if we want to talk about justice reform, if we want to talk about incarceration issues or some of the different things of our society that I really believe that in the truest sense are nonpartisan, you need to look at what they're doing in this program. That's why I appreciate what they're doing so much. They challenge me with some things that I may not agree with, but they're willing to talk with me about, but they do a lot of good things too. And I'm really hoping that through this process, we can find some way to really listen to the proposals that they have. This and the sexual assault stuff is by far and away the things I support most in this. And I, just because the commissioner's still here, I actually am getting a little bit warmed up to his, what is it called, MMRA. I think there's some sense to that as well. But to the question that Mr. Shanklin, one of the questions that us law and order people ask, we hear what you're saying about youth, okay? And I believe you with it. But there's still this framework of needing to have some level of accountability. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, because some of your stuff even opens a door for that. But can you explain to this committee kind of the perspective of your office or the program that you and Katrina are doing that shapes the whole package so that we are, you know, because offenders still do offend. They need to know that they're doing something wrong. So can you just address, you've given me great answers in the past that I think people need to hear. So can you please address that issue?
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Miller, I think you know in our past conversations that even amongst the times that we disagree, there's just a profound amount of respect. So I think, you know, any question that you ask, I look forward to just the conversation that we have about those specific questions. In regard to the question, I think, and I've said this a number of times, I think one of the advantages that both myself and my colleague, Director Dexter, have is that we don't just come from this, although we are both educators from an academia standpoint. We both have been, as we say, in the trenches doing this work. So we both have worked in facilities. We both have been adult and juvenile probation officers. We're both PREA auditors. So I say that to say is that you'll never hear us say no child should ever be placed in secure confinement. That's just not the reality. Unfortunately, some of our youth make some very poor choices that would warrant them to be placed in secure detention. However, what I think is important to note, and Ms. Mitchell talked about this too, even talked about the numbers on the adult side, is that when we look at the numbers, the vast majority of our youth are not engaged in criminal behavior that would typically warrant them to be placed directly into secure detention. There are alternatives that have already been utilized around this state for over a decade and some change that have proven to work. And so from our perspective, it's not this notion of where we're suggesting that no child should ever be held accountable or that they should never be placed in a setting to address their needs. I think from our perspective, it's making sure that we are doing everything and within our ability to assess and to make sure our youth are placed in the proper settings. More often than not, I think many of our stakeholders are looking to do great work, particularly if you take out in greater Minnesota. Many of our colleagues, whether that's law enforcement or other colleagues, a part of the courtroom work group, are looking at alternatives. They just don't have them. They just don't have at times those necessary resources. And I think that too is incumbent upon the legislature to begin to really analyze, particularly when we see many of our youth dealing with chemical dependency, mental health issues that we know they would better and be otherwise served in another setting. Unfortunately, absent of those resources, our detention facilities become the dumping grounds for many of those youth. Where they are not the appropriate setting to address their needs. And they actually put not only the facility, but the staff there at greater risk because they're not equipped more often than not to address their needs. And as we all know, and that's why I talk about our youth here in Minnesota, when we talk about putting them on the best trajectory toward being success, it's the understanding that many of them are victims and survivors themselves. And so how are we looking at common sense alternatives and appropriate settings that are grounded in both research and data so that we can make sure that we're not causing more harm, but again, that we are still holding those youth accountable where necessary.
OK, Okay, Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up.
Yes, please, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Paula. I'm not going to try and say your last name. But Paula, thank you. It's important that we have younger people get involved, particularly on issues like this. You did a great job. I just want you to know that.
I concur. Thank you, Representative Miller. Members, we're going to push on because I am falling a little bit behind. Thank you to Ms. Akagbu. I hope I pronounced that correctly, as well as to Deputy Commissioner Shanklin. Next part of the offer involves offering the Minnesota Rehabilitation Reinvestment Act, and the otherwise referred to as MRRA. That's in Article 12, lines 186.16 through lines 195.9 in the House language. We did hear quite a bit of this on Tuesday from the commissioner, and as you heard earlier, the commissioner, upon request from Chair Limmer, provided some materials that was forwarded, I believe, earlier this morning to all committee members on this. So I do want to move through it quickly. What I want to do is hear from Kevin Reese, who's a formerly incarcerated person, to offer a perspective of this powerful idea from his lens as someone who was in our system. So, Mr. Reese, if you can come forward and give us your testimony, state your name for the record, give us your testimony, I would appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm Kevin Reese. Thank you all for holding this space. It's a honor to be into this space, particularly talking about this particular bill, which is something that's near and dear to me. You had said it a little bit before we started. Yes, my experience, I spent 14 years, 5 months inside of Minnesota correctional facilities. I've been released for about 20 months now. I spent from the age of 18 to 32 inside of Minnesota correctional facilities, which is some very important developmental years. I grew up in Minnesota correctional facilities. And this particular bill is attached to something that we slept with is our dream. So right now, currently in the state of Minnesota, incarceration is just kind of like this long road. There is really no connection between, the incident that took place and why you're in prison, particularly for those who have done long terms in prison, right? There's a place in the middle of it that we refer to as like the middle passage. When you've done every program that the facility has to offer, you could have like a impeccable discipline record. You could be engaged with your family. You could be doing everything that you need to do, but there is still like nothing back from the system, right? So for folks who end up in that system who's already like used to not being able to have their positive efforts be reinforced, right? There were so many days we would sit down and we would say, wouldn't this make a difference if some of these days mattered or some of these programs mattered or some of these initiatives that I did mattered? And with them not mattering, I've seen them, people lose hope. I've seen people lose hope because they come to a place where it's like, I could do all of this stuff and none of it matters. So having a DOC where the rehabilitation, it's kind of on, the individual's own merit and their own actions, what I know from experience, it would literally change the culture inside of the Minnesota Department of Corrections, because it would turn from a place that's like, instead of just like warehousing, this feeling of just like being warehoused, I come in on this day, I leave this day, everything in between is kind of like a smokescreen, none of it matters. It would literally give purpose to every day that someone is inside of the correctional facilities. Also, it would make it for a safer facility for the incarcerated, for the staff at the facility, because it will give space to this level of leadership that exists among the men and women who's already currently incarcerated. There's already such an amazing group of human beings who's incarcerated inside of Minnesota correctional facilities. And if given the chance to shift culture where these days matters, these programs matter, I'm telling you, more people than not would be there every day encouraging each other, complete this program, do this thing. The average phone call with someone's family would be different. The family member would be able to encourage their loved one based on like, are you doing these programs? Are you doing this program? And the family would be more engaged in their rehabilitation. Also, in this amendment, there is language around, nonviolent offenders. I must say, as someone myself who went to prison for felony murder when I was 18 years old, I want to address public safety. I'm in the public now. I want to be safe too. My family want to be safe. Everybody want to be safe. But we have to examine this a little bit further. Some of these folks who are in there for, you know, instances on paper that say violent, they were children before they committed these instances. So for another bill to come out that just right off the top that will completely just erase them, what we will be doing to, again, telling this group of people, you're not welcome, you're not valuable, the thing that you did is unforgivable, right? And some of these folks are suffering from mental health and emotional issues, right? And if there is no space for them to be able to have this path back through rehabilitation, it's again telling them that they're not valuable, that what they did is unforgivable, and there's no way back for them. So I must say that, and I would love to see this stretch, but this is something that's retroactive that can actually be systems-wide, that can impact everybody. And I want to go back to something. The most important thing for me is that there's still a level of you have to earn it, right? This bill, this Reinvestment Act is not saying give nothing. It is saying there will be an opportunity for folks based off their own merit and their own actions to rehabilitate themselves. And it would be something that we can all see taking place right in front of us. It's more of a tangible thing versus rehabilitation. Right now, it's very abstract. It's just based off time. It's you come in on this day, you leave on this day. And there's really no way that we can track if he or she has been doing this thing that we call rehabilitation. And this program would be something that we will be able to identify. We will be able to say, this person did this, 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 this. And it would be based off their own merit. And it would give folks the opportunity, maybe for the first time for a lot of folks, for their positive actions to be met with positive reinforcement. Right. It would absolutely it would give that sense of that as well, too. And the last thing is how the reinvestment part, the fact that the reinvestment back in the community, it would continue to like create these pathways for folks to not only like come through incarceration, but on the back end of incarceration, feel like there's a place for them left in the city. There's a place for them in the world where they will also continue to be reinvested in. And I'm here today because this is something that's near and dear to me. This impacts a lot of people that I know, that I love. I know how much it would have impacted me during my incarceration. Those 14 and a half years sucked, y'all. I ain't gonna lie, every day sucked. And particularly the last 4.5 years, you would think it gets easier at the end. It doesn't, because you come to a place where I had did everything that the system had to offer. I went 11 years without going to say it. 11 years, and it meant nothing. It meant nothing. Every time you get a 6-month review from your case manager, hey, you could have just went 6 months. How much stuff I avoided, how many times I switched in my cell when crazy stuff was going on, like the day-to-day that it takes for someone to like stay out of trouble and stay out of the way, it's not acknowledged at all. And what it can begin to do, if it's not acknowledged and it's not supported, it will begin to like be counterproductive with rehabilitation. And also, it would be a space for folks to be able to almost make amends. Because now I know me, there's a part of me I've never fully been able to say sorry to my victim or my victim's family. So I still live with that every day in community. So I'm still not whole. I did 14 and a half years and I just came in on this day and I left on this day, but there was nothing that directly addressed while I was in prison. So I'm still in community right now, not feeling whole and complete, or I can say I'm fully rehabilitated from that, because there was no process. It was just me there from this time to this time. And this particular bill and program will shift the culture inside of DOC. My work as a community organizer, I'm talking to the men every day. This will give so many people something to live for, something to look forward to. And each one teach one, it's a part of the institution. Anyone that's familiar with the DOC, there are people in there every day, like teaching each other, learning from each other. And if this bill was to pass, and if this was a new memo that came up and was on the board, because we get so many memos, right? There's so many memos. If this memo goes on the board and this is happening, it would absolutely shift the culture inside of the facilities to one around, we got to do whatever we got to do to get home. Will there be some people that fall through the cracks? Absolutely, yes. But I think the folks that fall through the cracks, it will be easier for us to identify them and give them the help that they need. Because if there's someone inside of the facility and everything is in front of them for them to get home to their loved ones earlier, and they're still doing things, those disruptive things inside of the facility, I would like to bet if we were to further examine this, he or she, this same person, they are probably suffering from something else, and we need to get them some different kind of help as well, too. So I also think it would help us identify the folks who need, because everyone is different. We, you know, it's a collective, but everybody's, you know, individual needs, because we all individuals. This program would allow us to identify the individuals who needs a little bit more help. But the vast majority of folks would absolutely take this as an opportunity to have their rehabilitation, something that they can walk out every day. So I'm in complete support of this because I know how much it would have meant to me, and I know how much it would mean to all of those who's currently incarcerated. And the biggest part about it is the reinvestment part, because the goal is to get them back into community for them to be taxpayer citizens and contributors to our society. And this program will give them a pathway to it.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. I really appreciate the time and the thought and the spirit and the soul that you put into you being with us here today, sir. And I think we heard echoes of the prior conversation. I know that Senator Limmer, Chair Limmer, spoke, didn't quite use the word purpose, but I took it as that way, in terms of those conversational things that are powerful presence in our lives. And I think that's what you're sharing in terms of what is the need. I want to congratulate you on your journey. It sounds like you're still on it, and you're honest about that. And I do want to congratulate you on being with us back here in broader society. And I know I can hear it. I know that you left others behind that you care deeply about, and I know that you're looking to speak on their behalf as well. I'm going to see if anyone has any quick questions. I am a little bit behind in time, so I just want to see if anyone else has a comment or a question, then I'm going to push on. All right. Very well. Mr. Reese, thank you, sir, again.
Thank you guys so much. And anything that I could do moving forward about this, again, I can't say it enough. This is something that's really near and dear to me.
I'm going to take you up on that.
Absolutely. All right. Peace and blessings. Y'all have a good weekend.
Peace to you as well. Thank you. Members, next we're going to hear from Carly Stark of MCAT, the Association of Community Corrections. And this is for the other part of the offer, which is probation violation reform, House File 1761, and jailhouse witness. Actually, we'll have another person speaking on the jailhouse witness testimony. Again, members, you will find in the author the precise location of House File 1761, Articles 11, Section 33, Section 40, and then Section 42, 43, and then there's very specific line items here. These deal with detention provisions, reference to CCA counties, and last resort and rehabilitation. So Ms. Stark, if you can come forward, tell us about these provisions and your advice for us. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, Chair Limmer, Chair Becker-Finn, Chair Matthews, and members of the committee. My name is Carly Stark, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. And from now on, I will be referring to it as MACAC. MACAC represents 34 Minnesota counties that provide supervision under the Community Corrections Act and supervise more than 70% of people on probation or supervised release in Minnesota. I want to begin by thanking Representative Hollins for her work on this language and her commitment to creating a policy that balances both public safety and rehabilitation. Over the last 10 years, probation practice in Minnesota and nationally has changed dramatically. While no system is perfect, community corrections professionals in Minnesota strive to provide support and services for clients through the use of evidence-based practices. While probation agents certainly have a role in enforcing court conditions, the present goal of community supervision is to provide rehabilitative services and targeted interventions that reduce recidivism. In addition to behavior change programming, agents facilitate access to resources such as transportation, housing, employment, education, and treatment. The intent of probation is to support clients in a way that prevents future involvement in the justice system, which ultimately improves community safety. Most clients move through the supervision process without violations. Others do not. Even for those who struggle, our agents try to file a formal violation report as a last resort. And I want to emphasize that, you know, this is seeking to address a problem, but violations of probation are, again, a last resort. There are often many sanctions conferences or violations of probation prior to any request of the court for revocation of a stay of sentence. That said, we also recognize this is not always the case. We understand that probation agents are not perfect and are subject to the same stresses as other criminal justice professionals. This provision would provide an additional way to ensure that minor violations that do not have significant public safety implications are not a reason to revoke a stay or send a client to prison as a first step. It requires stricter review by judges of recommendations from probation to ensure that those recommendations are consistent with evidence-based practices. It also allows our agents to use discretion in instances that pose a significant risk to public safety. So basically, this provision requires that a judge not say yes to a request for revocation on the first occurrence of certain technical violations. So failing to abstain from the use of controlled substances without a valid prescription, except in, for example, DUIs. Failure to contact your probation officer, failure to maintain or obtain employment, failure to do vocational training. Some of those minor violations, people should not be sent back to prison or to prison on the first of those. As a reminder, this provision would apply only to probation violations and not to violations of supervised release. We know that for some, this bill does not go far enough, and for others, it goes too far. We recognize that it isn't perfect, but are committed to working with stakeholders throughout the legislative process. The standalone bill passed with broad bipartisan support and a nearly unanimous vote in both the House Public Safety and House Judiciary Committees, and we encourage that it be accepted by the Senate and the House in this omnibus bill. Thank you for your attention, and then I will remain on the call.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Stark. Next, we have the jailhouse informant witness regulation, and we're going to part of the offer. We're going to hear, and members, that's in Article 5, Section 9, line 47 of the House language, as well as Article 8, Section 7. And again, these will be spelled out in the formal written offer today. But to hear to tell us about this provision and the why, Julie Jonas from Legal Director for the Great North Innocence Project. Welcome to the committee, and please give us your name and your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Chair Limmer and all the committee members. My name's Julie Jonas. I'm the Legal Director at the Great North Innocence Project, formerly the Innocence Project of Minnesota. We've expanded to be a regional hub at this point. I would also like to specifically thank our legislative advocates and chief authors, Representative Long and Senator Ingebrigtsen, who is our lead author in the Senate. Senator Ingebrigtsen has long been a champion of Innocence Project's priorities, and we're proud to have strong bipartisan support on this bill. As you know, there's no fiscal note on this bill, so we would greatly appreciate the support of the Senate GOP to include this in the omnibus bill. What we're talking about here are jailhouse informants or jailhouse witnesses, different from confidential reliable informants. This bill would not affect that their use by law enforcement in any way. Rather, simply jailhouse informants or people who are typically housed pre-trial in a jail with a higher value suspect. They usually have lower value crimes that are not as severe, but they target a high value suspect in the jail. Someone who's typically there on a murder, rape, kidnapping, and they sidle up to that particular high-value suspect and obtain a confession from him. And I don't mean confession in the truest sense. I mean that they are coming forward with false evidence. These are people, these high-value suspects are typically claiming their innocence and have been vociferous in their innocence throughout their wait for trial. And now all of a sudden, the jailhouse informant will say, well, this person suddenly confessed to me, will come forward to law enforcement and see if they can get a deal for obtaining that confession and conveying it to the jury. This is a problem because it has led to a number of wrongful convictions. When looking across the country, we see that 17% of DNA exonerations involve testimony from jailhouse informants. Looking just at non-DNA exonerations, that number does go down a bit. But here in Minnesota, we have faced this problem in some high-profile cases. Some of you may remember the testimony before the various judiciary committees of Mike Hansen. He's a Minnesota exoneree who was accused and convicted of killing his daughter, exonerated many years later because, in fact, his daughter was not murdered at all, but died of positional asphyxia. There was a jailhouse informant in that case. That jailhouse informant testified against Mike Hansen and said Mike had tearfully confessed to him, even though Mike had consistently said he was innocent and had turned down an offer for no jail time to serve. This jailhouse informant, in exchange for his testimony against Mike, had a second-degree controlled substance violation, reduced to a fourth degree, only served 6 months in jail, received his car back from a forfeiture, and had a tampering with a witness charge dismissed. That was pretty good incentive to testify against Michael falsely. In addition, some of you have seen some a particular high-profile case in the news. It's not our case, but it's the Mayan Burrell case, where there were five different jailhouse informants used against Mayan Burrell. I should tell you, we have a similar case, a client who is ours, Terry Olson, who also got out of prison for different reasons, but he also had five jailhouse informants testify against him. And one of those informants was also used in Mayan Burrell's case. So we have informants who are testifying in multiple different cases. This bill is very simple and very straightforward. All we're looking for is to get the information to the jurors on potential credibility issues with these jailhouse informants. We're asking for tracking. That can be held at the attorney can be done at the attorney general's office, where they would track the use of jailhouse informants. Prosecutors would report when they use jailhouse informants. That information would be kept at the attorney general's office. And when a prosecutor sought to use a jailhouse informant in another case, they could be provided with information on how often that jailhouse informant had testified in other cases, because right now there's no way to know that. We know of cases in Minnesota where there have been jailhouse informants who testified in two, three, four, five, and six different cases, same informant that everybody is just magically confessing to, right? There's no place to keep that information central. So we're asking that the Attorney General's office keep that information. It can be as simple as an Excel spreadsheet. We're asking for enhanced discovery on informants to be sure that the full scope of any deal that is being made with them in exchange for their testimony, whether that deal is made explicit or is implicit, be provided to the jurors. We're asking for details on any cases, obviously, that it be disclosed to the jury, any cases that they've previously testified in as a jailhouse informant and anticipate that they will testify in the future, and also details of any cases that are pending. There's no way to know about these pending cases unless, of course, the informant volunteers them. And if those cases are dismissed in exchange for the informant's testify, it'll never be known. And finally, a component of victim notification, that if the informant's case that they will be getting a deal on involves a victim, the victim should be informed of that deal so they have a chance to have some input on that deal. We don't know how often that happens in Minnesota, but there's a nationally high-profile case, the Curtis Flowers case. Some of you may have heard about it on the In the Dark podcast. He was released after six trials in Mississippi. He had repeatedly informed as a jailhouse informant against Curtis Flowers, repeatedly having cases against him dismissed until ultimately on one of the times he was out between the fifth and sixth trials, he killed his girlfriend. So we would like to see victim notification as a component of this bill as well. Six other states have passed this type of legislation and are quite happy with it. It's been a no cost, no fiscal, no bill, and I hope you'll support it. And I'll stay on the line to answer any questions anyone might have.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Jonas, and thank you to our legislative authors of this bill, Representative Long and Senator Ingebrigtsen. And then finally, in this section, we have our prosecutor resentencing bill. And I believe we have Mae Lim to come forward to speak to us about this issue.
Good afternoon. My name is Mae Lim, and I'm the Senior Policy Associate of an organization called For the People. We are a national organization, and we support prosecutors who are working to reevaluate some past sentences that no longer serve the interests of justice. Our organization is led by Hillary Blout, a former prosecutor who drafted California's prosecutor-initiated resentencing law, which is very similar to the proposed bill being discussed today, House File 901. Our law and the bill before you today gives prosecutors a direct, streamlined way to provide redress for people serving excessive or unjust sentences. California's law went into effect in 2019, and Washington State passed a similar law last year. Similar bills are also being considered this year in Illinois, Texas, New York, Oregon, and Florida. Like the California law, the proposed bill in Minnesota is not a mandate, but rather it is discretionary. So elected county attorneys can make decisions that are in the best interest of the communities they've been elected to serve. This bill would help prosecutors carry out their role as ministers of justice through giving them the discretion to look back on past sentences on a case-by-case basis. With this tool, prosecutors can take a measured approach in addressing sentencing inequities from past decades and ensure that we're not wasting taxpayer dollars to confine people whom it no longer makes sense to incarcerate. This bill ensures that each specific case is carefully considered before moving forward, and it also puts in place a system of checks and balances. While the prosecutor has discretion, the voices of victims must be considered, and the judge is ultimately the one who makes the final decision. There is bipartisan support around this bill in Minnesota, and it also has the strong support of Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, and Attorney General Keith Ellison. I'd like to provide some context for how this law is operating in California. California has 58 district attorneys across our state. Since the law took effect in 2019, about a dozen DAs have opted into using this law, and others have simply opted out. Those that have opted in include Riverside, San Diego, and Yolo counties, which demonstrate that there is a wide range of counties on board, large, small, medium, rural, urban, and with prosecutors from across the political spectrum, conservative, progressive, moderate. Two main questions came up when this law was being considered by the California legislature. First, how will victims feel and how will they be incorporated into this process? And second, will there be issues in terms of floodgates opening and the court being inundated with frivolous claims? With respect to victims, victims are central to the decision-making process in California and would be in Minnesota as well. The victims' rights written into this bill ensure that victims would be able to participate in the process if they wish to, and to ensure their voices are heard. In fact, in all the cases we've resentenced in California, the victims have either been supportive, didn't remember the case, were no longer with us, or were surprised that the person was still incarcerated. We're actually finding that when the prosecutors are engaging the victims, there's an opportunity for victims to receive some additional closure, or sometimes even closure for the first time. The process has helped provide information to victims about some of the drivers for why the person committed the crime, and about the person's transformation and the hard work they've put in to become ready to re-enter society, which has included accountability work and writing remorse letters. We've seen cases where people have made remarkable transformations, demonstrating that people can change over time. As it relates to the flood of cases or the concerns that the court and other systems would be unnecessarily inundated, this process is extremely methodical and careful. The cases are brought forward by the prosecutor, so there's a lengthy and thorough review before the prosecutor decides whether to bring the case to the court. The bill lays out specific factors that the court may consider in the review of the sentence. So prosecutors will first take these considerations into account before bringing a case to the court. And some of those factors include a person's disciplinary record, rehabilitative efforts they've made while incarcerated, and whether the person would pose a risk to public safety if released. Because of this careful review process, we have not seen an influx of cases flooding the court in California. Now, in our third year, our organization has helped release 20 people in the last 2.5 years, while there have been about 50 releases total across the state. This is not a law that will create any problems with floodgates being opened. And while the number of people who have been resentenced under our law is modest, the impact has been very meaningful. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to share about prosecutor-initiated resentencing in an avenue that prosecutors in Minnesota can use to pursue justice. And I'm available for questions if there are any. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Lim, for your testimony and also for your work. We are behind, but I'm going to stop for very quickly to see if there are any questions or comments on the three previous bills here. The prosecutor resentencing bill, jailhouse reform, and probation violation reform. All right, very well. Members, I'm gonna push forward. The next part of the agenda is the presentation of what the House refers to as the Hardell-Sherrill Act. This involves jail and prison safety issues of life matters, quite frankly, or that involve life matters, but more than that. I'm going to ask Commissioner Snow just to do a quick explanation of the bill, and then I do want to hear from families that have been tragically impacted by very tragic events here in our jails in the state of Minnesota. Commissioner Snow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will go through this, do an overview of the bill. The focus of the Hardell-Sherrill Act is to protect the safety and health of those incarcerated in facilities and to prevent unnecessarily loss of life. We know, and we've talked about the fact that at this time, you know, the spotlight is shining on Minnesota in significant ways. And the media has also laid bare some incredibly disturbing and harrowing events that have taken place inside jails across Minnesota. Today, you will hear from, and I want to thank Delcia Perry, who will be providing some testimony. Mr. Brett Huber Sr. Had planned to testify today, but his father had a medical emergency in Minnesota, and here in Minnesota, and Mr. Huber had to obviously focus on that, but he has provided, his testimony has been provided to you and will be emailed to you if you have not already received it. He also indicated, asked me that to share that he intends to reach out to conferees to answer any questions that you may have. But Mr. Huber lost his son in the Todd County Jail some years ago, where we had found some irregularities in documentation. I understand the responsibility that DOC has to address the crisis we face. I have listened to those impacted and worked closely with the Sheriff's Association and community organizations to bring forth legislation that really updates something that has long been left dormant. We have heard from Bill Hutton, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, that they are still generally supportive of the language that we brought forward. You should know that there have been a number of amendments that have been made in the House to get the bill in shape before you today that were led by other partners such as NAMI, from which there was a perspective to strengthen the bill, but may are is different than what the Sheriff's Association had originally signed off on. As I've laid, as I said before, the DOC's inspection framework and statute is a long need of updating, and that this bill does that, and its goals are really threefold. First, it ensures some minimum standards, it increases transparency, and it ensures accountability. And so I'd like to, at this time, Mr. Chair, just do a very quick, just a few slides to share with some process changes that are being proposed with this. And then we will, hopefully you're gonna see this. Are you?
I do see that, Commissioner.
Okay, good.
It doesn't look small on my screen, but you might want to make it a little bit bigger if possible.
Oh, it's okay. That means.
Oh, I see. This is the first page with the slides on the left. I got it.
Yeah, well, it should be.
You want the full slide.
Yep, I'm trying to get that there. So we'll.
Senator Limmer, folks your age, my age, and the commissioner's age, we all wrestle with this technology.
It can be a struggle. Every day is a little different.
Older boomers.
Mr. Chairman, every year it gets worse for me.
So I think hopefully you can now see that first slide.
Looks good.
All right. We'll move us through. So what this slide does is it currently both statute and rule govern licensing and sanctioning actions in our jails. And our authority is broad without many parameters or built-in accountability. Minnesota Statute 241.021 permits an order of deficiency, order restricting detention to 72 hours, condemnation proceeding, revocation of license, but there are no timelines provided in this process and no due process. DOC rules permit sanctions as such for things such as compliance orders or limited restrictive use agreements, sunsets, or condemnation, all of which are disconnected from statutory authority. What is considered a serious violation versus what isn't is subjective today. And I think this just, if you walk through from the left to the right, you can begin to see what happens today. While we have some of these provisions built into the law, there is not a sense of exactly what's going to occur, and it does become quite subjective. There are limited appeal rights for a facility that may take issue with a DOC licensing action. And our bill, this bill really provides a level of procedural fairness. And as you can see from the flowchart, the mechanisms of sanctioning are siloed, confusing, and the statute lacks any kind of distinguishing guidance on when and how to use them. When we look at process that is being proposed, there is a, after working with the Sheriff's Association and other stakeholders, we codified elements of the correction of deficiencies. And a framework was aligned that with both statutory and rules. The first is the correction order. You can see the blue line there, which is issued for non-serious violations of minimum standards. The DOC inspection and enforcement unit is designed to be a resource to licensed facilities. And we view this as a way to provide technical assistance without interference in their regular operations. An example would be a facility lacks a policy on a given subject or topic that's required by rule, in which this case would be flagged for them and resources provided for them to establish the authority. The second licensing action is a conditional license order, which is issued when the nature, severity, or chronicity of violations of minimum standards require more serious action. An example would be when a particular room, such as a rec area or wing, has been deemed unfit and necessary repairs have not taken place. The next action would be the revocation order, which is used only after severe and chronic violations, taking into consideration the nature, severity, and chronicity, and the effect on the health, safety, and rights of persons housed in a given facility. You will note that facilities can remain operational during the process of issuing a revocation order, which requires notice and provides time for response, the due process elements. An example of this would be when a facility refuses to correct deficiencies or fails to meet those minimum standards after repeated correction or conditional license orders. And this brings me to the fourth licensing action, the temporary or immediate suspension order. This is modeled after licensing that exists in other states, including North Dakota. This is the revocation side of this, which really focuses heavily on those cases where there is imminent risk or life-threatening harm or serious physical injury could be caused to people who are housed in the facility, their staff, or visitors. Next, this is the process that was created and built into this statutory language. This process was created with the needs of both the licensed facility and the regulatory responsibility of our state in mind. Much of the statutory language added to this bill provides parameters for what must be considered when issuing any of the four licensing actions and how that must be articulated and communicated to licensed facilities. Moreover, it prescribes a process for notice and reconsideration to licensed facilities and the rights that are afforded to them, not afforded to them in our current existing processes. You will note we have aligned the actions in a way that establishes clear guidance and standards on when to use them. This framework also allows the agency to lift orders or sanctions once satisfactory process has been made and compliance achieved. So it just walks you through this process, but it provides more clarity of exactly what should happen as you move from left to right, whether there is the inspection finds violation or no violations, and then what options now the agency has to carry out its regulatory responsibility and provide absolute clarity for the facilities being licensed in our state. So that just gives you a sense of overview. And I want to just quickly walk through the language itself. The language, which I believe you've all have, is broken into 10 sections. Section one creates the specific categories of minimum standards the DOC must develop guidance on, including things like screening and mental health assessments, medication administration, well-being checks, discharge planning, and policy and training standards, to name a few. It also clarifies licensing expiration and shortens the time frame for reporting in-custody deaths to 24 hours from what is currently 10 days. Section 2-5 update the licensing framework and create the licensing framework that I just covered in the PowerPoint, which is that process elements. Section 6 requires the department, our agency, the DOC, to post licensing actions and status of license on the public website, similar to what you see for facilities like childcare centers on the DHS website. Section 7 establishes annual reporting requirements for the department to report to the legislature, including information on individuals who died in local and state correctional facilities. Right now, the legislature has no idea and has not provided information on the number of people who die in state facilities or local jails. There also will be providing aggregate information on death review results, uses of force, suicide attempts, medical transport, and the use of segregation. We'll also provide aggregate information on individuals committed to the custody of the DOC but housed outside of DOC facilities. And we'll provide summary data on complaints and discipline for state facilities only. Section 8 is simply relocates the existing definition of correctional facility into statute for formatting purposes. Section 9 requires that all correctional facilities provide a release of information form upon intake for health condition in the event of incapacitation of the incarcerated person. Right now, there are times when someone becomes unresponsive and facilities cannot tell families anything, which causes tremendous anxiety. And this change is simple, but has huge impact for those people who may become ill during the term of their incarceration. Section 10 requires correctional facilities to create a death review process within 90 days, fulfill or complete a death review process within 90 days of an in-custody death. This is something new this is something that we at the DOC have been doing for a number of years, and many local correctional facilities already do, and it has been deemed a best practice. Section 11 amends the correctional officer discipline and use of force statute to prohibit certain restraints, including chokeholds, and defines when set deadly force is justified. It also creates a duty to report when staff observe neglect or excessive use of force. I recognize that this is all very technical and tedious, but I can assure you that hours and hours of careful work went into preparing and developing and polishing the package that you have before you. Four elected sheriffs from various parts of the state who were identified and are members of the Minnesota Sheriffs Association were part of the working group to help us develop, review, and revise this language. And much of their feedback has really been built into this language. I should also point out that in 2007, the legislature studied this issue. In 2016, there was an OLA report on jails. In 2019, another one. And now CARE 11 has this ongoing series, Cruel and Unusual Punishment Series, highlighting the urgent need for reforms. We must stop admiring this program. We can no longer continue to measure it. We have to start to take action. We worked hard to develop a proposal that provides for levels of minimum standards that Minnesotans expect. It lays out rigorous inspection standards that must be met in order to comply with our statutory obligations to oversee the matters of health and safety, and frankly, life and death in correctional facilities across our state. I want to close by reminding you that Minnesota has had far too many deaths of people in custody. Nationally, suicides account for 31%, as I've mentioned before, but in Minnesota, it's double that. 60% of the deaths in Minnesota's jails result from suicides. I want to thank you for your time and for giving me the opportunity to provide a very quick overview. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would yield the remainder of the time to Delcia Perry, who I think will illustrate the importance of this policy.
Thank you, Commissioner, for the careful walkthrough of that. If I recall earlier in your testimony, and I know this was shared in the House, the use of force standard hasn't been touched since the early 1900s. We're talking about a standard that applied to a different period of time, and the duty to report, I would argue, reflects some of the, similar work that Senator Limmer and I and some others worked on this summer, as it applied to our licensed peace officers. In this case, it would be, applying to our guards, our COs and staff in our Minnesota prisons. We do have a constitutional duty to protect life in our facilities, and I'm real pleased to see this come forward. I do want to. I'm sorry that we're not able to hear from Mr. Huber. He has a very powerful story to tell. But we do have Ms. Perry here, who also has a powerful, heartrending story of loss to tell relative to this. And so I do want to express my deep appreciation for Ms. Perry to be with us here today. Please know that our wishes of love and peace and healing and support for you is strong here. And so grateful for you to take this time to be with us here today. So with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Perry to come forward and give us her testimony.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much, Representative Mariani, Senator Limmer, Senator Letts, and the rest of the committee here. I thank you all for your time on today. As you all know, tomorrow is Mother's Day, and that's going to look quite different for me, because 2.5 years ago, Hardell Cheryl walked into the Beltrami County Jail, and let me put emphasis on he walked into the Beltrami County Jail on August 24th of 2018. 3 days after my son would arrive in this county jail, he called me, telling me he had fallen out of his bunk. And they had left him on the floor for about 30 minutes. This would be the first time that Hardell would call me. When he realized that nobody was taking his concerns seriously, he would call me yet again. And this would go on for several more days. By the time Hardell called me on about the fifth or sixth day of him being in custody, he called me crying this time. He said, "Mama, they don't believe me. They think I'm lying. They think I'm faking it." I prayed with my son because I am a praying mama. And I have a relationship with the Lord. And it is through his grace that keeps me strong, fighting for this kind of change that must come. 2.5 years, I've been fighting for justice for my son, for his three little girls who no longer have a father, for his mother who lost her only child. It has been devastating, to say the least. But after about the sixth day, he called me crying. My son has had a very high tolerance for pain. But when he called me in tears, saying, "Mama, I can't even stand up to talk to you on the phone. My back is in excruciating pain." He said, "Mama, get a lawyer and have them look at the video cameras because they're mistreating me here." I prayed again with my son because that's what I know to do. I said, "God's in control. He's got his hands on you." I assured him that he would be okay. Because as a mother, when your child is in custody, and I don't know, maybe some of you all have never had a child in custody. Maybe you've not experienced what I have experienced. Sure, we know Hardell made some mistakes. That's why he was there. But Hardell was a good kid. He made some mistakes. He suffered from ADHD. He thought to self-medicate himself. He struggled with depression, but he was human. He was my child, and he made some mistakes, but he was ready to own up to what he had done and was prepared to pay his debt to society, but they didn't give him that opportunity. Because as you all know, 9 days later, my son was taken out in a body bag. 9 days. 6 of those days that my son lay on a cold jail cell floor, he suffered agonizing pain with no medication, no one to really help. They didn't care to help my son because they kept saying he was faking it. I don't know how you can fake blood pressure. I don't know how you can fake limpness, drooling, and his side of his face was, it looked like he'd had a stroke. I don't know how you fake that. O2 levels were very low. I don't know how you fake that. A blind man could have seen my son crying out for help, but yet not one somebody, and there were several of them there, for he was in for 9 days. Not one correctional officer decided to say, "Wait a minute, something's not right here. Wait a minute, this isn't adding up." As I said, my son walked in to the Beltrami County Jail in good spirits, considering what he was facing, which, by the way, was not a life sentence. He was looking at 5 years, to be exact. You can look it up if you care to do so. And on good behavior, he would have been out in 3.5. That's according to state law. My son was my everything outside of God. He was my best friend. We did everything together. Everything together. And when I lost Hardell, a big part of me died. But I have to lean on my Lord because I know what his word says. It's what gives me the strength. It's what gives me what I need to continue to fight. But I know to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So I know my son is in heaven and he's no longer being tortured or ignored or disregarded as a human being. What if that were your son or daughter? And you know, it could happen. You don't know the circumstances. Nobody knows tomorrow. Nobody knows what tomorrow will bring. I pray to God what happened to Hardell never happens to none of your children. I pray to God that you don't have to suffer like I have had to suffer for 2.5 years. And this is now my new life, this new fight. It's not fair. It's not fair that I have to join this fight. I called to the jail. I begged everybody that I could talk to. Please help my son. Please, please go and help my son. Marlon Smith was one of the correctional officers that I called and spoke to. I figured my son would trust him because he was a Black man, Jamaican native. But Marlon, he went around. He didn't care to get my son up and get him on the phone. I said, if my son does not get up and come to this phone and speak to his mama, something is seriously wrong. And you need to go and do something about it. Take him to the hospital. Get him the care that he needs. I would never hear back from Marlon Smith. As I looked at the videos, and there are plenty, I saw exactly what they did to my baby. And if none of you have seen those videos, I challenge you today to go take a look. I challenge you to go and take a look. They're very hard to watch. Hardell, on about the 6th or 7th day, had become paralyzed. He was becoming paralyzed every day, but it got worse. We later would come to find out that Hardell was suffering from GBS, which is Guillain-Barré syndrome, wherein your immune system attacks your nervous system and you become paralyzed from the inside out, slowly but surely. But get this, it's curable. It's treatable. Hardell should be here today. He should be here today. He may have been in a wheelchair, but he should be alive today. Hardell died a senseless death, egregious. They let that baby lay on that floor, a cold jail cell floor. When they finally did take Hardell to the hospital, thank God there was a whistleblowing nurse. Thank God for the whistleblowing nurse who went in and saw Hardell and said, he is in extremely a bad situation. We need to get him to the hospital immediately. I'm not a nurse, but anybody could see that there was something not right. And she surely saw that. She went by all the vital signs and told Dr. Todd Leonard, who didn't give two bits about my son. Even the jail administrator, Ms. Allen, said, no, he's not going to the hospital, because she was concerned that he was trying to escape. Now tell me, how can a man run when he can't even walk? He could not walk, but they were concerned that he was going to try and escape. Lord Jesus. When he went to the hospital, the doctor there saw him. And because he did not use his professionalism in diagnosing my son and committing him and keeping him in the hospital, which is where he certainly deserved to be, he listened to one of the correctional officers. And one of those correctional officers said, he's fine. He was moving his legs the night before. So he listened to them. Sent Hardell back to jail. When Hardell arrives in the Sally Port, you can see him. He's lost all control. His limbs are, he has no control, no body function. My baby fell. They allowed him to fall out of that vehicle on his knees on the cement. They tried to put him in the wheelchair. They unsuccessfully succeeded. And I believe there were four strong correctional officers there. And you would think that your reaction would be, oh, let's hurry up and get him up off the floor. No, that's not what they did. They let him fall back on the floor. And I see my baby lying on this cold floor on his face. And they were standing around talking about God only knows what for several minutes, mind you. They then get him back in the wheelchair. Hardell's head flops back. Excuse me. Hardell's head flops back. And one of the correctional officers pushes his head forcefully. You can see Hardell crying. Who knows what's going on in his mind at this time? He probably is thinking, I'm going to die in here. Helping me. He did not deserve what they did to him. Not deserve it. He was not a monster. They get him in to his cell. They got him handcuffed here, got him handcuffed on his feet. And these four officers drag him as if he's a piece of meat. And they just throw him on this bed. And before they leave the room, Hardell's arm is hanging out off the bunk on the floor. You would think that the correctional officer, somebody would recognize that and say, oh, wow, let me get his arm and put it in bed. Let me pull his shirt down and put the blanket on. I've never been to jail. But I can just about imagine it's probably not very nice in there, and it's probably very cold. They throw him on the bed, and his arm is just hanging there off the side of the bed. Hardell's trying to get his arm back in the bed, but he cannot because he has no strength. His head is hanging off the side of the bed. And he tries to get his head back in the bed, but he can't even do that. Eventually, Hardell falls off the bunk. And he's left there on the floor for nearly 8 hours. We know there were no well-being checks being done because if they had been done, he certainly would not have been on the floor for 8 hours. In the same position. In the same position. They didn't care. They didn't care. Finally, they roll him over, they get him. The next baby on his back and they leave him on the floor. He starves to death because he can't eat. I don't hear it. He was starved to death. He couldn't swallow his own saliva. He couldn't drink. He couldn't eat. And they knew it. I wonder, how am I going to tell this little girl? How am I going to explain this to this little girl? All they know right now is that their daddy was in jail and he got sick because they didn't give him medicine and he died. That's what they know. It's too much to tell them, of course. So I continue to fight for justice for my son. It's been 2.5 years. Nobody's been fired. Jail's still operating. Dr. Leonard is still practicing medicine. Nobody's held accountable. Nobody. There's no accountability. And I just say to myself, God, why? Why? My son did not deserve what they did to him. And that's why this bill has to be passed. It has to be passed. So that there are these measures of safety for somebody else's son or daughter. We know we're not going to get Hartel back. But what happened to Hartel should never happen again in another Minnesota jail or any jail in any of the 50 states, God.
It's a painful story to hear, Miss Perry. To hear a mother's loss is beyond... I have no words other than to say that your loss of your beloved son doesn't mean that we need to lose other sons. Doesn't mean that we need to have other mothers go through the pain that you have gone through and are going through. The pain that Brett Huber Sr. Is going through and his spouse over the loss of their son and another county members. This is not a one-time issue. Our work before us is to create the powerful policy frame so that our work in our jails and our prisons always place human rights and human dignity at the center of our actions and our work. That's our constitutional duty. We can't just leave it, to our locals to do that work. They need the state to provide the kind of structure that Commissioner Schnell shared, the kind of accountability, so that we can work together with our locals in a powerful way to always stay focused on respecting and honoring the lives of people like Hardell. And so, Ms. I want to thank you for your courage today. But I also want to thank you for your love, because you're here as much out of that motivation for your son, but also for the sons and daughters of others as well. And let us see, members, what we can do, guided by these words of wisdom and this pain. Members, so we are running short of time. I'm going to call on Chair Becker-Finn first, and then I know several other members also want to weigh in here. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And First, I want to say that I was born in Beltrami County. I was born in Bemidji, where the Beltrami County Jail is. And when I was growing up, my mom was a public health nurse, and she actually was one of the nurses that served folks in that jail, you know, going back 20, 25 years ago. And particularly in recent time, in addition to the death of Hardell, there have been other deaths as well. And I think to Hardell's death, I thank you, Ms. Perry, for speaking today. I know that it's traumatic to share that with us, but we're listening, and I think it does make a difference. And I know I heard from your attorney, I've heard him say that in all his years of litigating, he's never seen a case as egregious and inhumane as what happened to your son. And I know that I am dedicated to making sure that doesn't happen to anybody else. I also wanted to lift up that just in the last couple of years in that same jail, there have been other deaths. And there hasn't been accountability, and that's why we need to do something about it. I know Stephanie Bunker died in custody in the Beltrami County Jail in 2017, and she left behind four children. Tony May died in 2016 in the Beltrami County Jail. He also left behind four children, and that's just in the last 5 years. So that is seven, you know, that is, 11 children growing up without one of their parents because of what's happening in just this one jail, in addition to what we know is happening in other places as well. And so I just really wanted to highlight that this is Bemidji is rural Minnesota. This is a problem across our state, and we can choose to act. And I think that obviously is the right choice to make. I just, the dehumanization of our fellow human beings who are in custody is unacceptable. And I know that some folks don't like to think about it in this frame, but Stephanie Bunker and Tony May were both Native. And Hardell was Black man. And so when we have disproportionate impacts on different communities, we need to talk about that, because there are systemic reasons for why that's happening. I'm not saying that, you know, the individual people who were in that jail decided to treat these people in a dehumanizing way just because of their skin color, but it's also having a disproportionate impact on our communities, on these communities when that happens. And so I think it's important that we recognize that, because Stephanie and Tony and Hardell should still be here. They should still be raising their kids. And we have a chance to make sure this doesn't happen to other people. And so I hope that other members, other conferees were really listening closely today to the testimony, because it is powerful, and these people's lives mattered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And I do want to share that if we had heard from the Huber family, this did involve another county. It was Todd County, where they lost their beloved son, who was having a bipolar episode, and where there's a settlement that resulted from that. And at the core of it was the filing of falsified wellness checks, the father repeatedly calling and being told that his son was fine, and that the reports reflected that. Subsequently, it was discovered that those were false claims. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Perry, I'm sorry. And those words are incomplete and thin, but that's the best that I can offer you, and I mean that sincerely. The question I have, and I'm going to give my follow-up answer to it right away for the sake of time, and I don't know who can answer this, but what happened to those people that were responsible for this? Because here's my problem. What I think I just heard from Chair Becker-Finn is they essentially weren't held accountable, and the jail being sued is not being held accountable. One of the challenges that we have in our system is the people that perpetrated this have to be held accountable. They need to be charged with the crime. They need to lose their jobs. They need to be charged with the crime. And that needs to be dealt with as well. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because the patterns that I've seen in the state of Minnesota is we don't do that part of it. It's easy. It's cheap to give someone money for something that they lost. Okay. It's important to put in safeguards so this doesn't happen again. But the people who perpetrate this stuff need to be dealt with. And I hope that as a state, we can agree that that will happen.
Let me ask Commissioner Schnell just to very quickly respond to that. I do have two others that also want to have a question or offer comment, including Chair Limmer. Commissioner Schnell?
Mr. Chair, and that was a Representative Miller, one of the things in the bill and one of the things that the legislature took action on last year was when there is a failure to report, a failure to take action, and a failure to report that, that is actionable. And in this case, there were reports made and was determined that the other STEM staff did come forward to administrators and others, reported things through the medical system. And yet that was not acted upon. So I think, you know, what ends up happening is the accountability mechanisms are built into this and are critically important. And I think unless we lift up policy and bring forward the seriousness of this, that's when things start to happen. And that's when accountability can begin to occur. And tragically, we always are in, reacting. But I believe that this bill will help lead to that, those types of outcomes and that level of accountability.
Representative Mueller.
Did you say Mueller or Miller?
Mueller, I'm sorry. Representative Mueller. Kelly Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. I just wanted to give my heartfelt thank you and sincere sympathies to Ms. Perry. Thank you so much for being here. And you know, you started this by saying that tomorrow is Mother's Day. And as a mother, can't imagine to begin to imagine the pain you feel. And I think about all the other mothers who have come before us in this committee, but not only in the last few days, but over the last few years. And I don't know how often we have to hear from people's trauma and grief before we take action. It's really time for us to dig in and start taking action on these bills. That's our job. That's what we're here to do. The public deserves that from us. That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Chair Limmer.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Ms. Perry, I want to extend my sympathies to you as well. Many of us are people of faith, as you are. And I know it may be difficult, but I do hope and pray that God brings you the comfort that you need. I think these moments when you can express yourself on behalf of your son, hope that takes you another little step toward that goal. We're terribly sorry for your experience with your son, and then to see it on a video and see the progression of that end result, I can't imagine at all what you've gone through. But I do want you to know we will be praying for your comfort and your healing. And I believe your son is well taken care of in the next life. I know I can sense that, I can feel that. And if he caught anything in his upbringing of your faith, it's there. So thank you for coming up and giving us that very difficult testimony. I greatly appreciate it. Ms. Chairman, I would like to ask Commissioner Schnell a few questions,
please,
if possible. Commissioner Schnell, you and I are familiar with correction procedures within a facility. In this particular case, there was reference to a video. Are video cameras required in every county jail, do you know, or a workhouse?
Commissioner? You're muted, Commissioner.
By now you think I should be on top of that. I'm sorry. Mr. Chair and Chair Limmer, I would say that, you know, that generally speaking, yes, in there is requirements. They have some ability to kind of oversee, but frequently we know that we video cameras don't cover everything. In this particular case, you know, there was a video cameras that were available and covered the lion's share of Mr. Charles' treatment and progression.
One other quick question for the commissioner.
Of course,
Commissioner Snell, are there? I know I've worked in a workhouse, but we had very specific walk schedules in front of every cell. We did that, I think, once every half hour, and we were looking for specifically health reasons or a suicide watch. That was very specific to our duties. And you certainly got your walk in because you had to move rather quickly. But nevertheless, is that required in jails as well, to have a constant walk-by of a cell? I'm just troubled by the fact that this young man was isolated, and then with the initial reasons why he fell ill, there wasn't more of a constant watch on him. Or if there was a watch, then there's quite a dereliction of responsibility. In addition to a nurse watch that would occasionally go through jails as well, and at least where I was working, it was a daily basis. So are you familiar with this particular jail, and do they have that, and is that common in every jailhouse that we have?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Chair Limmer, yes, there are standards for rounds. There were rounds in some case. In the case of Mr. Sherrill, there was, as Ms. Perry pointed out, this paradigm, this belief that this was all fake, and that despite medical people seeing him, despite the fact that a nurse practitioner actually wrote a report and identified concerns, that was dismissed. And I think in the case of Mr. Huber, as Chair Mariani pointed out, at the very time that he had taken his own life in a jail cell, around was documented but did not occur. We have been addressing these patterns, and the inspectors are taking more time to make sure that they're looking at videos and the extent to which the logs for the very rounds that you're talking about match up. And these have been big problems. And this is where accountability in our systems, and trust me, I can tell you that when we talked to the four sheriffs that were involved in this process of these discussions, they wanted the same thing. They wanted to make sure that people were being dealt with well. And so that's what prompted, I think, the policy that's before you. These are shared concerns. And so I think those standards, but our ability to make sure that there is a level of accountability is, I believe, a state obligation. And finally, I would say, Mr. Chair, that the items that we're proposing in this bill are not just thrust upon county jails and other correctional facilities, but that we want to hold ourselves, the Department of Corrections, the state operating facilities, to that same standard. And we want to make sure that we're doing the kinds of inspections and audits that need to take place at that level.
Thank you,
Commissioner. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Chairman Limmer. Commissioner and members, it's this legislator's belief that it is the state's ultimate duty to secure the human rights of all our citizens and residents in our state. And as much as we want the locals to do that, we certainly expect that, and we want to partner and work with them. It is our duty to do that. And I think it's within the spirit of that, securing that responsibility, that this proposal is before us. Representative Lucero on my committee always asks, who's watching the watchers? It's just human nature. You have to watch. You need systems for accountability. Systems with better standards, and that involves making sure, in this case, that you have the state playing a powerful, hopefully collaborative role with our locals, so that we're watching over their behaviors, so that human rights are not violated. Members, we are out of time. There is an offer. I won't have time to do any lengthy presentation of it, senators, but it does involve there's 10 provisions. It involves the issues we heard today, some that we didn't, the Healthy Start Act, which hopefully will move off the floor, the Minnesota Rehabilitation Reinvestment Act, the Hart L. Sherrill Act that we just spent the last hour on, the juvenile treatment changes, probation violation reform, jailhouse witness regulations, prosecutor resentencing bill. We didn't talk about DOC, Department of Corrections ID cards, but that's also in there, as well as a corrections supervision working group involving tribal governments, so that we can work even closer and tighter with our neighbors, tribal governments. A number of these enjoy bipartisan support, have gotten bipartisan votes in the House. There are authors in the Senate on a number of these, including authors from the GOP in the Senate. I hope that the Senate will seriously consider this offer and bring us back a counteroffer to that. So I want to present that to you today. I did say earlier that I was reading off the lines, and then I realized that what we had sent out earlier actually did not have the lines in it. So I apologize for that confusion. It's important to be ultimately transparent with our partners in the Senate. And so I just had the staff, put out, an update to that. Members, a motion of hearing, and it is absolutely appropriate in my mind that we offer our love, our concern, our prayers to our people in Minnesota, Ms. Perry, and others for their loss. Absolutely, that's the human side of us. I hope we never lose track of that. And members, we're also challenged to act. We're also challenged to problem solve, as well as to extend our love. Quite frankly, in my belief system, love means action as well. And so I hope that, the bills that we bring forward, that they are seen by the public as motivated by both love, by responsibility, and in the spirit of problem solving as well. And so it's in that spirit that I hope the Senate receives this offer. And I look forward to hearing back from the Senate. Chair Limmer, I'm going to give you the last seconds, just perhaps update us on what your plans are for the next hearing. You do have the gavel, sir, for next Monday.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On Monday, we'll be starting again at 9 o'clock. For a period of time, we will be listening to police officers, law enforcement, regarding some of the items listed in both bills. So it should be a rather dynamic discussion.
Very well. Any other members, any last words before we head off into the weekend and Mother's Day here?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, so they're last, please.
Thank you. My name was invoked in the beginning of this hearing with regard to going over details of legislative proposals, and I want to clear something up. I do wish to see the details of legislative proposals, but I also do not wish to waste my time on proposals that are complete non-starters in terms of the end game here and trying to pass anything into law. But I think it's a little unseemly to suggest that because there weren't page and line numbers in an offer, that it wasn't a serious offer, and there's no way the Senate could figure out what the heck the House was asking for. I mean, there are bill summaries, there are brilliant staff, there are line by lines of everything available for all of us. It's not hard to find what the proposals mean, even though it's only in one sentence in an offer. Unless you can't read English, I think you can figure it out. So that's not a valid excuse in my book. I'm afraid we're getting the same answer that I got all session when I was asking for hearings on bills, which was, we don't have time. It's a budget year. And That also is really unseemly. We were elected to do a job. And not just to say no, not just to sit here and offer our thoughts and prayers. I think God makes us instrumentalities to do what needs to be done, not just for us to sit back and hope that God takes care of things. That's why we're here. And if we fail to act, we are complicit with the outcomes. History has taught us that in so many ways, and it applies just as clearly here. How can we not be moved by the testimony that we have heard in the last couple of days of proceedings and just ignore it and say, I'm sorry for your loss, but we're just not going to do anything? Those words ring hollow if we do nothing. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Senator Lantz. Members, we are out of time. Much love and peace to Ms. Perry and her family. And hopefully we will act, and you'll be watching as we do that. Thank you so much. Members, with that, until Monday, I believe, when the Senate has a gavel, this conference committee stands adjourned.